conversations. I'm just going to make it.
We couldn't get this thing to work with some problem like that, so there isn't a... So I guess you can put that at the point.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, that's too bad. Okay, I can move it.
Okay. So the slide will be...
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'll probably just talk to it.
We'll start in a few minutes.
Come on, I can't.
Literally have that.
Wow. those are the words. Intro to anything.
Well,
the
yeah, so we're happy to be able to be happy. And once you tell me that, I've got to tell you.
Start the introduction and keep it short. And then,
deal.
Turn to the slides and you're on. Well, good morning. We're about ready to start for day two of our summit symposium. And we have a very interesting and inspiring speaker today who I'll introduce briefly. He asked to keep it short. Dan Kaufman will be our speaker this morning. He's for the keynote. He's director of the DARPA Information Innovation Office, where he's responsible for identifying and creating promising new information technologies and developing DARPA programs to exploit these advances. Before being named as director of I2O, he was the DARPA Defense Science Office Program Manager, responsible for the real-world program, which was a computer system designed to allow soldiers to rapidly create their own mission rehearsal scenarios in geospecific terrain over a scalable and distributed network. I won't go into details on the rest of his bibliography, but it is very interesting. He spent time in the video game industry and the digital entertainment industry with DreamWorks Interactive, as a lawyer in the high-tech industry, and as a lots of other things. So it's a very diverse background, and I'm sure it'll be very interesting to hear how he weaves all this stuff together.
Yeah, it means I can't keep a job. That's what it means. So, all right. Just one quick question, just a quick show of hands, just so I know how to sort of guide this. How aware are people of DARPA? Just very? Okay, cool. We're going to blast through. Awesome. All right, so I call it six impossible things before breakfast, and if you know DARPA, you can figure out why that intrigues me. All right, October 4th, 1957. 7:28:34, Sputnik launches. To the great surprise and unhappiness of the American public, there's sort of panic ensues. Most people didn't even know there was a space race. We wake up to find out we're losing. The president has to take to the airwaves to calm people down, to let them know that our role in the universe is still fine. We still have technological superiority. And in fact, they're so motivated that the president and Congress, in exactly 4 months, creates DARPA. 4 months from that day. Think about it. And that, which I love showing this, that is the entire document that formed DARPA. That's it. Just says, hey, let's not have that happen again. And here's an agency to do that. And really, when you ask people what it is, I think sort of the number one answer I hear over and over again that our job is to create and prevent technological surprise. That's sort of the DARPA mission as given. And if you look over, 56 years and counting of what we've done, when you talk about technological surprise, the number one thing people always think about is the Internet. I love having this drawing because that is the Internet. You may not recognize it. It's grown a little bit since then, but that is actually the original drawing. But DARPA's done much, much more than that. Some people are aware, some people aren't, but I always think it's kind of interesting. So this just gives you an idea. So everything from the first mouse, but a lot of things we do are very tailored to the warfighter. Not surprising, we're a national security office. So everything from stealth to night vision. But so the way these come up, the Air Force says, we want to have invisible airplanes, right? So we go on and we try to figure out stealth. Or the Army wants to own the night, and we give them IR night vision goggles. Even NASA is arguably a spin out of DARPA. But not everything is military, right? A lot of this turns out to be commercial, although maybe the original focus was military. It turns out to be commercial. And so I always think everybody has a cell phone. The fact that if you're like me, you can't find anything. The fact that you use GPS in a small form factor comes out of DARPA. The MEMS devices, I don't know if people are familiar with MEMS, microelectrical mechanical systems, right? So here's the simple thing. If you have a cell phone and you go from portrait to landscape and you turn it and your phone does that, that's a MEMS device. In fact, Ken Gabriel, who was the deputy director, is really probably the chief architect from a DARPA perspective putting that together. And then Siri, which actually came out of my office. And so it's always fun to talk about Siri. I also talk about why technologists should never market anything. That actually is what the name of the program was when I owned it. It was called the Personalized Assistant That Learns. So, you know, thank God for Apple or somebody giving it some name other than that. And then as you move forward, you've got things like self-driving cars, which, you know, Google is obviously turning that into a commercial product, but that came out of the Korean challenges. I don't know if anybody went out to those, but those are a blast. And we're going to do another one soon, not on cars, but in cyber. So I'll cue you up about that. And then even robotics, which I find interesting that so Google seems to be fascinated with us because they just bought up most of our robotic investments over the last, I don't know, decade or so. So when DARPA came to me and they said, you know, would you like to run the office that invented the Internet? I, you know, after I first figured out that they actually had the right Dan Kaufman, because that was, that sounds great. I got very worried after I got the job because I thought, what is technological surprise? How does one build it? How does one create it? Now I'm responsible for it, so I have no idea what to do. And I know this will come as a great shock, particularly to this room, but I'm a nerd. So I said, oh, I'm going to research this, because that's like the only thing I knew how to do. So I started researching all the things up here and said, let me dig in and find out what technological surprise is, and then maybe I have some prayer of duplicating this or doing this again. And the more I read and the more I learned, I walked away with this very disconcerting and sort of strange answer, which is this. The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And what I mean by that was I couldn't find a single case of actual technological surprise. So you may think, well, what are you talking about? So let's go back to the foundational DARPA myth, right, the creation myth of DARPA. There was Sputnik, we launched, all true. But if you had 35 cents and had bought a copy of Popular Science 2 years before Sputnik was launched, you would have seen this inside the new midget moon. And it actually described all that technology. And in fact, if you went back and you read Wernher von Braun's autobiography, he will tell you this was well-known technology. And so you think, huh. So I thought, well, now that I found this wonder tome called Popular Science, what else might I find in this thing? So check this out, 1958. The car that drives itself. And there it is. And this is not a theoretical thing. This is actually a guy who went to Detroit, and he's talking about his experience of seeing this self-driving car. And, in fact, his conclusion I love, because at one point he says, you know, when's it going to come? And he says, not this year, probably not next year, but still soon. So, you know, give or take 50 years, kind of dead spot on. So it got me to thinking, well, if there's no technological surprise, what is that surprise? Clearly there is a surprise, and clearly people get jumped and worried about it. So what's going on? And I thought, what the real surprise is a disconnect. It's when there's a disconnect between the way that you hope the world is, or the way you would like the world to be, or the way you have fantasies about the world, and the way the world actually is. And when those two things... aliens, this is cool. So you know that that DARPA has all the aliens? They're monitoring us. So I don't know what they're saying yet, but...
Translating.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So the question, so you start to say, so what are these disconnects? And I started to rethink that maybe DARPA's mission instead is to try to understand what these disconnects are. And so this is a great quote by John Maynard Keynes, who said that the idea of the future being different from the present is so repugnant to our conventional modes of thought and behavior that we, most of us, have a great resistance to acting on it in practice. And I thought, that's what's going on over and over and over again. If you think back to Sputnik, right, it wasn't that the technology surprised us. What surprised us was that the Russians did it. We had a worldview of them as sort of third-worldly and agrarian-based. And in fact, many people have surmised, and I think it's probably true, had we launched Sputnik, they would not have been as surprised. And yet, I don't want you to think it's an old thing. This idea of not being able to see what's right in front of our face happens over and over and over again. One of my favorite examples, because I'm kind of a fan of him, is Jeff Bezos, right? So Amazon, right? So Amazon's really cool, so let's think about what did Jeff actually do? Well, he didn't invent the Internet. We've just established that we did that, right? Al Gore notwithstanding. He didn't invent e-commerce. He didn't invent books in the printing press. That was Gutenberg, any history majors, you know? So what did he do? Well, he had a vision, right? He had a vision of the way the world would be. He had a vision of the way sort of e-commerce would happen. He thought we could sell things at scale. And what was fascinating is he has an idea, and he's competing with this massive infrastructure of bookstores. And the bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and if you remember, if you go back and study, the comments are fascinating. They explain all the reasons why he's wrong. And some of them were great. One was, who's going to give a credit card online, right? Okay, there may have been a little oomph there. We've all seen Heartbleed. But there were questions of, like, people enjoy the experience of going to a bookstore. They're going to miss this. And my favorite one, my absolute favorite one was, well, you're just never going to have the selection. I love that. Right? Because you used to think, yes, the bookstore is compared to, I don't know, the internet. But here's what's funny. Even though we can mock them, and you're watching this, as bookstore after bookstore after bookstore closes and closes and closes, here's the weird part. Then Bezos says, well, you know, Amazon's not just about books. I think we could sell anything like this. And large department stores, I remember this at the time, one guy, CEO of a major department store, said, well, what, like he's going to sell a vacuum cleaner? Yes. I just bought a vacuum cleaner 3 weeks ago. On Amazon, it's perfect. Prime shipping, boom, one day, there it is, $30, done. So, you know, when we talk about these disconnects, it seems obvious, but the question is, and I think that's DARPA's role, is if we can understand sort of where the future is, sort of where the current trend is, if we can extrapolate a little bit further from that, we can start to guide our research, right? So let's talk about a couple of disconnects that my sister offices are looking at, and then I'll dive into big data because that's my office, right? So one disconnect one of my sister offices is looking at is their claim is, and I think they're right, is that we currently live in what we call the golden age of antibiotics, right? So the way things work is you get sick, you go to your doctor, he gives you this magical pill, you take the magical pill, and then you're fine. And we don't even think about it, we kind of complain about the copay, right? That's our entire input into this process. And it's amazing when you think about it, because that pill that you're taking, right, is curing a disease that would have wiped you out 50 years ago. Like, there would have been no recovery from this, and you're fine. And they're saying that what we're at now is the end of the golden age of antibiotics, which sounds sort of alarming. And they showed me this chart, which I thought was fascinating. So this is the number of antibacterial new drug applications and their approvals. And you don't need to be a deep data guy to say this is not a good trend. This is now. And then you thought, well, maybe, if you're snarky like I am, you say, oh, well, maybe that's because we've cured everything. So we don't need new ones. And then they showed me this. This is just this year, it was 2013, the number of illnesses caused by antibiotic resistance and the number of deaths caused by antibiotic resistance. And you think, that sounds terrible. So the reason I show that disconnect is it changes the way DARPA approaches things. So we have all sorts of new programs going on. Everything from, okay, so maybe we need to create nano-sized, literally nanoparticle-sized machines that can get into the bloodstream and we can deliver drugs to a specific place at a specific time at our choosing. Or maybe we need to find ways to accelerate the entire drug process. So what if we could put the entire human immune system on a chip, right? So all of a sudden, what you invest in changes because you have an idea of this future coming, even though people don't want to talk about it, because one thing about disconnects is they always make you uncomfortable. Right? So I'll tell you a second one that sister offices is doing, which I love. I don't know if people are familiar with Norm Augustine, but Norm Augustine was the CEO of Lockheed, very bright man, has a bunch of rules. My all-time favorite Augustine law is this one. So what he did here, on the x-axis, we've got years, on the y-axis, dollars, and he plotted every modern aircraft, okay, military aircraft. And after plotting all these points, he draws a line right through it and says, look, you have enough points here that extrapolation seems reasonable. And you can see, so right up here with the F-35, you can see that at the cost, you can see the year. And so then he projects out, because that's the fun thing to do with data, and this is the conclusion he reaches. He says, in the year 2054, the entire defense budget will purchase precisely one aircraft. This aircraft will be shared by the Air Force and the Navy 3.5 days each per week, except for leap year when it'll be made available to the Marines for the extra day. So, again, it causes DARPA to take a step back and says, okay, so when you talk about things like sixth-gen fighter, you talk about these new things, maybe we're not talking about the next amazing aircraft, more stealth, more things. Maybe we need a new approach. So we look at things like system of systems. Could I build amazing capability out of a bunch of lower cost things? Could I do networking things? And so that's sort of how DARPA takes things and drives and drives change based on sort of looking at where we are, looking at the future. And this makes you uncomfortable because if you're a large defense contractor and your job is to build, you know, whatever comes after the F-22, this is not it, you know, they would prefer me not to talk about this. But I think that's sort of DARPA's role. It doesn't make us right, but it changes the way we look at the world and what we do. So now let's talk big data because that's where I live. And I think there's a huge disconnect coming. But before I can talk about the disconnect, I got to make sure we're all on the same page about big data. Because I think people use this term all the time, and I don't think anybody knows what they're talking about. If you ever hear talks, it's always fun. Just raise your hand. I do this right. How big is big? Is it the bigness? Is it the complexity? What, and then just walk away because that's like 4 hours of discussion, and then you can come back to no answer. So just to make sure we're on the same page, this is an idea. So in 2015, we're talking about being at 7,910 exabytes of data, which is actually 7 zettabytes for, you know, you little math geeks out there. So, and this is just fun if people don't know, because you know what's after zettabytes? Yottabytes, which I always say is a Jerry Seinfeld thing, like is in yada yada. That's not true, so don't quote that. There's actually a reason for yada, but it amuses me. But just to put this in context, so an exabyte is one with 18 zeros. There is no way you can get your head around that. To me, it's like when you talk to astronomers, right? You have to, at some point, just give yourself over to the number and just go, okay, it's just lots of zeros. But to give a little context, you see this little tiny white line here? That white line is 5 exabytes. Just 5. It is estimated that 5 exabytes is the total amount of human spoken language since the dawn of mankind. Okay? Not including this talk, so it's like going a little bigger. So that's 5 exabytes. So here's another way to look at it, just so we're all on the same page. It's kind of fun. So there are 571 websites created every minute of every day, 48 hours of video loaded to YouTube every minute of every day. That is an amazing number of cat videos. So if you don't like have Reddit or whatnot, then you don't even know which one to watch. Or here's another way to look at it. I think this is kind of cool. So if you take all the data in the world and we spread it out on that table, it would be a heck of a table, and we put it there, and we took away, we'd say 90% of that data was created in the last 2 years. 90%. And yet we believe, most estimates are less than 5% of the data is used because it's too expensive. What I mean too expensive to deal with, either time or money, because it's effectively the same thing. So when I say big data, that's what I'm talking about. So where's the disconnect? The next disconnect is I think that we as a species, honestly as humans, we have moved into a new realm very quickly and very subtly, and nobody's talking about this, which is that our lives are now inextricably entwined with computers and software at a fundamental way, and that we don't even understand it. It affects our lives in deep and meaningful ways. There's literally nothing we do today that is not driven by computers and software in some way. The way you communicate, the way you buy things, the way you socialize, you get in your car, you think you're driving your car, you're not driving your car, your car is making thousands of decisions for you at an amazing speed. So if you understand that, you start to think it affects your lives in really powerful ways. And the second thing you find out is that actually you're not in control of most of this, that actually the people who control that software and computers and algorithms is a handful of very small technologically elite people, right? Most times I give this talk, none of those people are in the room. In this case, some of you may be in that class. But nonetheless, let's play a game. So let's think banker. So just in your head, think banker. Everyone have a mental image of banker? All right, my guess is something like this, right? Banker. But what if I told you that well over 50% of transactions, banker, that's the banker, right? And just to give you an idea, in the amount of time it would take you as a human being, just time to click a mouse, this thing can operate tens of thousands of trades. So this idea that you're sort of on par and competing with this is nuts. And you might think, okay, well, that's fine, but what does that mean to me? It means a lot to you. This was the flash crash. A lot of people call it the flash crash of 2010. I like calling it the flash crash of 245 because that is exactly when it happened. What happened was the Dow Jones plunged 1,000 points, 1,000 points in just a few minutes. And in 14 seconds, these algorithms traded 27,000 contracts. Here's what's amazing. Not only did this all happen, After a year and 8 different separate investigations, no one can tell you why. We don't know. I mean, you know, we're sorry you lost your money. Our bad. But we have no idea what happened. That's your pension funds. That's your IRA funds. That's all that stuff. It's just gone. Some of it comes back. Some of it doesn't. We have no idea what's going on. Right? So you might think, well, okay, so that's fine. You scared me off banking, but, you know, I'm an academic. I'm a researcher. I don't have any money anyway, so what am I going to do? So let's talk about search. Here's the second way you're being influenced, I think, in a very, very powerful way. So when I say search, what most people think when you say search is they think there's this, like, software equivalent of that, you know, nice little old lady with a bun, and, like, you come up with this search term, and you say, I wish to learn this. And then she runs around and she looks, she gets all the files available in the world, searches through them, and then gives you this list of 10, the perfect 10 list of blue links, and says, here, right? Except, and I was trying to find a way of thinking what people think search is like. So I don't know if this will play in this movie, but I don't know. So we don't have the movie. All right. So I had this really cute movie. You never worry about it, but it was fun, where it shows the new library at North Carolina State. Where it's just amazing. It, like, goes. You got to go see this thing. It's, like, mechanically goes through and loads all the books in and brings it back. So that's, you know, let me assure you, it's probably in this room, as you know, that is not how search works at all. So here's how search actually works. When you send a search, you send a search term to one or two or three of the largest ad companies in the world, who have indexed somewhere between 1 and 5% of the entire internet. That's it. They've chosen what they've indexed based on an algorithm to make them the most money. They take your term, and then they bring you back a search in a specific order, again, by an algorithm generated to make them the most possible money. There's nothing bad nor nefarious in this, but you have to understand that's a long way away from somebody bringing you and searching the entire internet and bringing you stuff. It's actually brought to you within an order. Now, again, you might think, look, I'm an independent person. I'm a smart guy. You can't catch me. I don't just look at the first link. I dig three, but you don't. Data shows us you absolutely don't. This is the odds of you clicking on the first link, the second link, and then it goes down. So now you think, okay, now I've learned that, so maybe I'll look deeper and maybe I'll be there. But it's more nefarious than this, and it's more insidious, I suppose, than you may realize. So people familiar with the Rap Genius case? So if you're not, it's really cool. All right. So there's a little company out there in Silicon Valley, I think, called Rap Genius. And they are smart data scientists. They're smart computer guys. They have a good company, and they saw this, and they said, okay, so clearly we need to manipulate results to become number one in the search. It's worth a lot of money. It's very powerful. And they spent some time, gamed the algorithms, figured out quite cleverly how to move themselves artificially up the ranking. Nothing wrong with that, right? Google, also equally fairly, looked at that and was like, that seems like a terrible idea. That's how we make money. We don't want you to do that. That seems terrible. And that also seems like a perfectly reasonable thing. But what you have to understand is there's an entire economic war that's going on. And we are about to become the casualties of this war, because here was the headline. Google destroys Rap Genius search rankings as punishment. And SEO spam was just the way they did it to move the rankings up. So here's the thing that's interesting. Anybody in this room from Google? Yeah? Anybody here from Rap Genius? So 99.9% of the world did not get a vote in this, but it affected your search. Whether you got to see data or you didn't see data is not in your hands. So when I say there's a disconnect, we're in this really strange place. We have to rely on computers. We have to do this stuff, and yet we're not in control of them, right? So whenever I give talks like this, this is how I think sometimes my audience feels, right? So we sort of feel like we're Alice in Wonderland. I love this drawing because, to me, it sums everything up. You look, first of all, she has a key to go behind a curtain, so you find out that's wrong. Then she looks behind. There's the Matrix. It's in color. She's in black and white. And I have a special forces friend who said that my talks are depressing. He said, because you tell us that the world's all messed up, but we don't know what to do, and it feels impossible. And because he knows I like Alice, and Mike, who works with me, found this quote, which I love, which said, there's no use in trying, she said. One cannot believe in impossible things, right? So how do you imagine a world in which this is not the case? Which is, of course, where the title of the talk comes from, because the wonderful thing about books is there's endless quotes in them. So here's the response, which is actually from the Queen. I try to believe in as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. So what I want to talk about in the last part of the talk is 6 impossible things. I'm going to break them into 2 groups, right? So the first thing says, if you've come with me on this journey so far and you now understand that you do not live in this universe alone, you will only live in it with computers and with information and software completely intertwined, the first thing you should think is, oh, I sure hope those things are safe and reliable. Because if I don't have safe and reliable computers and safe and reliable information, then I'm completely and utterly doomed. So I'm going to talk about 3 programs that DARPA is doing in that regard. Right? So the first thing is the Cyber Grand Challenge. I told you we talk about it, the next Grand Challenge. So Grand Challenge is fascinating to me. I'm excited about this Internet of Things. I think everybody's excited about this Internet of Things. It sounds awesome. I would submit to you that if we don't have a new security model, then we will never enjoy the fruits of this Internet of Things. And if you have a trillion devices out there, what does Patch Tuesday look like, right? It seems deeply terrible and terrifying. So the idea of Cyber Grand Challenge says, so we cannot compete on a human scale, right? With hackers on one side and us trying to hire people, we can't each individually at our own computers hire our own hacker team to defend our network. Like, you can't imagine it. And, today we do a little bit of automation. We buy antiviruses or firewalls or we buy stuff. But what we've proven over and over again is that human ingenuity can overcome these things quickly and easily. Cyber Grand Challenge sort of imagines, but maybe we're at a turning point. As compute power has increased dramatically, as the big data analytics are coming online, maybe we could take this on. And it's really fun for me because if you remember in the 70s, everybody said that, the idea of a computer being a chess champion was considered so ludicrous that chess players would not play a computer. It was deemed a waste of their time. So what did we do? Well, we created an all-chess computer league, and it was just all computers. And that ran for about 7 years until about 84, somewhere around there. And then we beat our first grandmaster, and then we beat Kasparov, and humans play for 2nd place. And then I remember people saying, oh, well, sure, chess, it's a very limited problem. Those of you who haven't programmed one, go try. But it's a very limited board. It would never do well in a human endeavor like Jeopardy. Yeah. So, Ken Jennings is still licking his wounds. And so Cyber Grand Challenge asked the following question. Could we have a computer actually beat a hacker? Could it happen? So I don't know if people are familiar. There's a place called DEF CON, which is a big hacker conference out in Vegas. Big fun. And they have a big tournament there called CTF, which is Capture the Flag, which is the closest thing you will ever see to real, actual cyber war. Thousands of teams compete all year to get 10 slots, and it's fascinating. You have to play offense and defense and white. So in other words, you have to keep all your services up and running all at the same time, and they compete. So we're going to set up the first all-computer version of that challenge. We've actually hired the team that's done it, and we're offering the biggest prize I think DARPA has ever offered before in a challenge, millions of dollars. So people should come. If you have students, they should enter it. Anybody can enter it. I think it'll be big fun. We're going to try to do a big AMA, I think, right around the beginning of June. So that's one approach, right? Second approach is Hackums. So Hackums says, okay, that's fine. I love the idea of having software that's going to go defend it. But here's a fundamental question. Why do I need that at all? If you think about computers, it is the only very expensive appliance that we buy ever in our lives that you buy broken. Think about that for a minute. You go to a store, you buy your brand new computer, and you're all excited. You give them $3,000, they give you the computer, and what is the first thing they tell you? Oh, it's broken. They say, yeah, you got to get home. The first thing you do, sir, you got to get home, and you're going to patch it. And okay. So then you patch it, and then you go, so now it's fixed, right? No. Well, what I do? Well, Tuesday, we're going to send you more patches. Oh, okay. Well, am I ever going to be done? No. No, never. And we accept that. Think about how crazy that is. There's nothing else in our lives we buy. There is nothing else you buy like that. For the most part, you buy your car. Like they don't just say, before you get your car home, sir, do this. Or your refrigerator, your stove. Think about anything in that. So Hackums asked the following question. Could you build, using formal methods, could you build a provably correct, fully secure computer system? And, I always like to say in DARPA, there's a fine line between impossible and crazy. And it's okay to be impossible. It's not okay to be crazy. So we usually look for an existence proof. So on Hackums, what we observed was that there's the SEL Linux kernel, which is about 9,000 lines of code, which is provably correct. So the question was, okay, well, maybe we could scale that up. So this program's looking at going to about the size of an RTOS, a real-time operating system. Think about 45,000 lines of code. If you can do that, you might actually have an Internet of Things that is actually provably correct. Whether we can do it or not, you know, remains to be seen. The third one I want to talk about is, even if I could hand you either a secure computer like Hackam's, or if I can't hand you a secure computer, at least CyberGrain Challenge, I can have software out there defending it so it'll feel secure. None of that actually helps you if the information itself isn't actually reliable. So, right, garbage in, garbage out. And there's many, many things we're doing in SMISC to try to understand that. But I think in your own personal lives, you feel this all the time. I don't know if people used Yelp when it first came out, but like everybody used Yelp, and it was really good for restaurant reviews. And now my guess is you don't use it, right? Because you feel manipulated now. It feels like, you know, it just feels like I can't understand what all the reviews are. They feel like they're bots making reviews and the like. And so SMISC is trying to starting to ask the question of, could I actually automatically understand the difference between human-generated data and machine-generated data? So there's this really cool concept. This is just one of them in there that I like. This is an old math concept, but I love it. Are people familiar with Benford's Law? Just curious. No? All right. So I love this thing. So here's a crazy story about this, too, because it's like science in a nutshell. So there's a guy, not Benford. So this is rule of science one. The guy's named after, didn't invent it. So there's a guy, there's an astronomer, and he's making observations. And he has a log table book, you know, literally, you know, with logarithms. And he makes this observation as he goes back to record all his planetary sightings. He notices that the ones are dirtier. Like they've been thumbed through more than the twos. And the twos more than the threes and on down. And he finds this very strange and confusing because, like, I don't think, like, astronomers and math people, it's not like we have some presupposition that we love one more than two. So what's going on? And he has a hypothesis. And it sort of goes away, and then Benford in the 1930s revisits this and discovers it and says, oh, so it turns out that if you have any large set of data, naturally occurring amount of data, lengths of rivers in the world, heights of mountains, whatever particular data you want, if it's just large and naturally occurring, it will turn out that it looks like this. This is a distribution of digits under Benford's law. The odds that the leading digit, right, so if you have a number like 1,283,412, the 1, it's most likely to be a 1, then a 2, then a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now, if you are like me when you see this, you don't believe this. So you're all going to make notes, go home and go do this for yourself, but I've done 2 for you just, you know, in case you're of the lazy type. But this is, like, so fun to do. So, and there's actually some really good, we can talk afterwards if you want. There's a whole math and statistical reason for this, and you can actually think it through if you do the doubling in your head. But here's a couple fun things. So here it is, comparing it to the 1990 census. Here it is, comparing it to the Dow Jones. Now, you might think, okay, well, that's really cool, so why does DARPA care? Well, let's imagine I'm looking for fraudulent data. In this case, we were looking for some fraudulent financial data, and I have a bunch of bad guys, and the bad guys are being smart, and they're going to hide these transactions. They're going to try to make sure it's under certain amounts and hide it, and see if you can spot the false data. Yes, if you've guessed correctly. So clearly there is something going on here, and there's no way to do that easily, right? So that sort of became the beginning of some of the work we've done in Afghanistan to roll up all sorts of financial frauds and the like. And it gets much more sophisticated, and you can do all sorts of stuff to game this stuff. All right, so let's assume DARPA is wildly successful, and I can actually give to you safe and reliable computers, and I can actually tell you the information that you're using to make these things is may not be true, but at least it's actually generated and it's real data. I would tell you that only solves half the problem. It doesn't actually really help you because very few people – so what are you supposed to do? Are you going to write your own search engine? So here's the next thing we need to do. We need to empower the end user. We have to make it – if we have to rely on these computers, we have to make it so that everybody can use it. You know, my guess is there aren't many coders at the talks I give. I forgot at one point. It's some shockingly small percentage of people that have actually written code, and then when you dive down and – you know, programming in Excel does not count. So, again, because I have a little OCD, we'll talk about 3 programs. So the first one we'll talk about is Memex. So Memex is going directly after this search program. It said, gee, I may have cause or reason in my life in which I wish to index the internet in a way that's different than Google. Now, if all I want to do is to sell you a better pair of jeans or to find something, I would argue they've done a perfect job. I wouldn't change anything. But there are cases where I may want to search the deep web. I may want to find that other 95%. I may want to find a particular subject, and I may want to go deep down. I think there are tons and tons and tons of commercial applications for that. I will leave that to the market. From the national security perspective, the first thing we're going after is human trafficking, right? So these guys are hiding behind chat forums and behind web forums and all that stuff. And we believe, and we've already shown some early results, that, I mean, it is just a scourge on the planet. And I always say, you know, if you want to figure out if you care about human trafficking, if you know a woman, you should now care. There are shocking statistics. One we saw was that the average price is $90. So if we can put a dent in that and end that, that sort of, you know, time well spent. But that's fine. So, okay, so we're going to give you search, and imagine I give you a search tool so that you can search the part of the web that you want, when you want. You can have the results brought back to you in an order that you deem interesting. You could have them brought back to you. Maybe you don't want it as a list. Maybe you want it as a graph, whatever. That's the idea of Memex. The second program is Muse, which is even slightly crazier, that said, well, okay, so maybe I want to do more than search. Why can't I just program a computer? Why can't everybody just program a computer? And the analogy that hit me a while ago, which sort of amuses me, we'll see if it amuses you, is that this is what modern-day programming is. It's like me and a German guy. And the two of us have very important information that we want to exchange. And we decide the best and most efficient way to do that is we're both going to learn Mandarin. And then we're going to be shocked when we don't communicate very well. If you would think about that, I would argue that is exactly what modern-day programming is. Because when you go to classes, I was just at Stanford a while ago lecturing, and I was talking, and I said, why do we learn computer languages, right? And you get the normal, right, normal perfect freshman response. That's how we talk to computers. And I said, yes, except computers don't understand any of the languages you do, right? C, Java, Ruby on Rails, Haskell, whatever the cool kids are programming in, it doesn't understand that, right? It'll have to go to a compiler and then translate that back into a language that it actually understands. And then we're shocked that we, who don't think very well in these obscure languages, don't translate our ideas very well, and then the computer doesn't understand them, and then it makes mistakes. That's also my always pet peeve. Computers don't make mistakes. We make mistakes. They do exactly what we tell them. We just haven't thought it through very well. So what if we could get rid of that? What if we could get to a point where we move humans into the space where we're really good, which is sort of describing in a logical manner what it is we want to do, a high-level specification. We talk that and have the computer write the code. Could we do it? So here's kind of a fun test that we're thinking about for the program. Imagine the following. There's, you know, there's billions and billions and billions of lines of open source code out there. I mean, it's amazing what's out there. So what if I take a little, like, ArgyCopter, right? And I'm going to take a huge database of all code. The only rule for this code repository is there will be no helicopter code and no ArgyCopter code. But, you know, there'll be sorts, and there'll be linked lists, and there'll be quick sorts, and whatever you want. That's all that. But it's random in there. It's in whatever language it's in there. It's just a mess of stuff. You then specify what it is that you wish this ArgyCopter to do. The computer will go off, move it probably to some intermediary language, x86 or LLVM. That's just for those of you programmers. If not, ignore that part. But it'll move it into that, compile it, and bring the code back, and you will fly that ArgyCopter. If you do, I will be running laps around the DARPA building. You'll see me screaming like a crazy man. I think we can do it. The two constraints I'm taking off the program, one is it will not be very efficient code, so I'm not worried about it being terribly efficient. And two, I've taken all the security constraints off it. I just want to see that it will work. But I think it would change the way we will work with machines. Since we have to rely on them, we have to get to a point where we just tell it what we want, right? The third idea goes even further, which is big mechanism. So big mechanism, just like the first two on computers were about computers and the first two here are sort of about programming, big mechanism looks at data and it says, so we're all excited about big data and we're all excited, but basically everything we see is correlation. I mean, we trumpet the hell out of this stuff and you can make a lot of money and we show low-hanging fruit where you do really well on correlation, but it never tells you why. Probably the most fundamental interesting question out there. So big mechanism asks a crazy question. It says, imagine that the cure for cancer already exists. Imagine it. But it's spread out over 100,000 articles 20 different languages. Each article is super obscure. It's some guy who spent his life saying, you know, gene A inhibits process B. That's it, with no understanding of anything else. And then there's some other article somewhere else that says, X influences Y. And imagine we could create a piece of software. Imagine that would go off, search all of it, and then bring it back to us as a causal model. So this is my picture for it. Oh, maybe not. It's dead. Aw, it's just a pretty picture. It's not the end of the world. I will. There it is. So imagine, that's just because I love that. So imagine that that's where it lives, and that's what we're going to do. So normally at this point, I sort of write, read, assemble, explain, that's how the program works. So normally my thought was, okay, I'm going to end the talk right here. And then I thought, well, I've only given you what we're doing, so I want to give you one step further, right? Since you've all been patient and you've lived with my crazy view of the world, let me take it even further, which tells you, here's where I think we have things wrong. This only takes us up to a point. Here's the next step. I think our view of computers and our relationship to computers is fundamentally wrong. We have a one-way relationship with computers today. We have some task that I don't want to do because it's too time-consuming or too slow or too annoying. I don't want to find large prime numbers. I don't want to proofread a document, whatever that is I want to do. I don't want to multiply a million numbers by a million numbers. And I create some software program, and I make it do it. And I am fully aware of its limitations and what it can do and what it can't do, and it gives me results, right? It has no concept of my limitations. It never gets asked back. It never gets to go, well, why don't we just do that in log? It's a lot faster, right? And if we're going to move into this new world, where I think it is, we're going to have to change our relationship with computers so that we actually have a conversation. So I would tell you that the future, the cloud will no longer be data and a bunch of CPUs, right? I would say the future is data and inorganic CPUs and organic CPUs. That's us. So, and we are going to live together in this odd little partnership, and we're going to go places. And so here's why it's important. If you think about big mechanism I talked about, so here's the good news and the bad news of that program. The good news is I actually think we may get somewhere. I think we may break down these causal models. I think we may be able to maybe reassemble them to some degree. Here's the most likely thing to occur. At some point, it's going to find a conflict. Computers are very good at doing that. We can do that very rapidly, and we can find this conflict. Computers are crap at resolving it, right? It's going to say, okay, so this paper said A inhibits B, and this said B inhibits A, and then we can write like lots and lots of weighted nets and neural nets and genetic algorithms, but the truth is we're just guessing and we don't know, and neither does the computer. That's what happens. But imagine instead, in my future, that's not what happens at all. The computer looks at that and says, I know that's a problem, and I know I'm not very good at solving it, but I know humans are pretty good at solving it. I think here's what I'm going to go do. I'm going to go look up the top 20 of grad schools, and I'm going to look for PhD students in oncology. I'm going to see who's got some free time. Oh, here's 74 students that don't have a PhD thesis. That seems good. Hey, look, Jim is free at 11:30. I'm going to call Jim up. Hey, Jim, this is Dell. I have this idea, and I think if you could work on this as your PhD thesis, we could, like, share a Nobel Prize. So, what do you think? And that would be the future, and I think that will happen. And all these are little component parts. We'll be able to talk to computers. We'll be able to do it. So if you've learned nothing else from this talk, I thought I was all excited. This is the thing I was going to do. I'm telling everyone about this vision, but as I've showed you, all you have to do is go back to popular science or go back somewhere and you'll learn something. So here's what I learned. I learned that before I was born, the guy who had my exact job, running my exact office. J.C. Hilichleiter said the following thing. The hope is that in not too many years, human brains and computers will be coupled together very tightly, and the resulting partnership will think as no human brain has ever thought and process data in a way not approached by the information handling machines we know today. So that's just way better phrase than what I just said. But the difference is he was talking about Algol, and I think we can move it forward. So with that, if you guys have a few questions, I'm happy to answer them, but that's it. All right. And if you've not read Hilichleiter, I would seriously, I would commend you, go read his papers. It's staggeringly impressive. I want to say anything that in 60 years actually has relevance.
Very interesting talk. Thank you.
Sure.
Especially the last few minutes, it seems strikingly relevant to what Kurzweil talks about in the whole singularity movement. So what are your comments there?
Yeah, no, I find the singularity stuff really, really interesting. I guess it's a slight different bent. You know, I think, although obviously Ray's got an amazing technical background and talk, I'm so much less interested in sort of the philosophy and talking about it. I actually like building it, right? So there's a quote that I left a long time ago that said, you know, they were asking DARPA, and I forget who it was, but somebody said, you know, how do you guys go about, you know, predicting the future? And the answer is, we don't. We just make it. And so what? So my charge is, I would stop giving lectures. It's like, he needs advice from me. But stop doing that. Like, sit down and actually build it. And that's why we're building Memex and Muse. So I think it's right, but I don't think it gets there by talking about it and arguing about it. Like, just build things. And here's another thing for the academic community, and I'm a big believer in. And I was at Microsoft, and we didn't do it either. But we need to share our failures. And we don't do it, and I just always take a point when I have a podium to say, that actually is how knowledge goes forward. And if you notice at DARPA, we're doing this. I have this open source catalog that I've released, which is open to everybody. It's every paper we have. I'm going to put them all up there. And I've had a few institutions stuff going, oh, well, that thing didn't work out well. I'm like, awesome, not a problem. Publish it. We'll learn from it. Because, A, I may learn a path not to go down. But, B, here's the crazy thing. In 5 years, it may turn out you were dead freaking right. You just had one wrong assumption. And why deprive us? We've spent... Plus, you know, at DARPA, we spent your money, so you might as well get to see it. All right. Up more. All right.
Some of the points you made. Tim Feiner from UMBC. Several of the points you made kind of focused on interaction between intelligent computers and people. Do you see kind of the barriers of... language understanding as being something that we need to make more progress on?
Yeah, we do. And so it's funny. So I, you know, like on everything, I have a rant, so be careful. So here's my rant on this. So why does everybody hate AI? And look, and don't kid yourself, you're an AI. Like, okay, everybody hates this. So why does everybody hate AI? So the reason everybody hates AI is because if you use an AI program long enough, it eventually gives you a stupid result. Always. And then... the user says, oh, well, I didn't like that result, so I don't trust you, so everything you say is crap, and I throw it away. And that's why it's not bad to be in the AI business, because then they just give you more money and you write another one, and it will have the same result. And it's asymptotic. You'll never solve it. But I thought about this for a while, and I thought, but we have friends, like most of us do, and we have friends that say stupid crap all the time, right? And you don't throw them away, right? So why? I mean, if they say stupid stuff too much, you do have that point, you know. But mostly no. So what is it? So what the difference is it's clarification. Because often it turns out your friend didn't really say something stupid. They misunderstood what you said. There was a clarification. You then figure it out, and then you solve the whole thing, right? Well, AI never gets to do that, and this is to the language point. So I think that if we're really going to be partners with AI, we have to stop treating it as stupid. We have to actually be able to have a conversation with it. So if you think about it for a minute, I was talking with a bunch of people at Google and other places that's worried about the FAA and they're worried about drones, right? And, oh, my God, pilots don't want drones because, you know, the computer's going to go crazy, right? So after I get my whole rant, like, the computers don't go crazy. People go crazy. Computers do what they do. They just do things you may not like. They may be impenetrable because we can't follow the logic, but they're following the logic. So come into, like, crazy Dan world. I know this won't surprise you, but in my view, imagine a UAV flying, and it sings a little song, because that's how I view them. And this little UAV is running around and singing this little song. It's like, I'm a happy little UAV. I'm traveling at 30,000 feet. If things go bad, I'm going to go down and left. And if that doesn't work, I'm going to go down and right. Okay? Now, when you think about it as a pilot, well, what scared me before was that AI was a black box. But actually, that's way more comforting than the pilot over here, who they trust. Like, I don't know anything about that human pilot. He had a bad day. His wife left him. He's been doing cocaine in the thing. He just fell asleep. I have no idea. He's a terrorist. I don't know anything. I have no idea. So if a bad event, God only knows what that guy's going to do. This little UAV, it's going to do exactly what I want. And I think we'll eventually get to a point, I call it explainable AI. So now in the future, and this is where language comes in, that when the computer does something stupid, and AI, it always will. And when it does, for the first time, I should be able to ask it just like my friend. So why did you do that? And it would say, ah, well, I have the following logical assumptions. And I said 1, 2, 3, 4. And I say, whoa. So there's a nuance on 3. And again, if my other programs work, you will simply explain it to them. You'll say, well, no, it should work like this. And it says, okay, great. And now over time, we're getting better. And I don't think we can do that without a better language in doing it, because that's how we talk. If I try to do it like an expert system or in code, I'll fail. Yes?
Steve Ray, CMU. So you just touched on a theme you hadn't really mentioned, which is learning. And
yeah.
I wonder what your thoughts are on that, automated learning.
Yeah, so look, so here's the first thing. If you're a grad student, go tell people you know machine learning, and they will just pay you six figures whether you do or not. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing I've learned. But I think the way learning should work is only as a hybrid with the human. I think this idea of trying to get the computer to, you know, it will eventually watch all things and learn all things. My personal opinion, just, you know, me, I don't think that's obtainable, and I don't think it's a good investment. Right? Doesn't mean we shouldn't get higher up the curve. I think what we want to do is make these computers self-aware about what it knows and doesn't. So, you know, here, I'll give you another example. This is sort of a, so imagine ISR. I went down to Crete Air Force Base, right? And I'm watching these guys. These are the guys who fly all the drones, right? And they have this crazy room where there's a guy, and I counted them. There are 40 screens like this. And I could not figure out what that person's job was. Because I was thinking, if you look, right, just do the math. I'm like, if you do look at each screen for 5 seconds, well, that's 200 seconds. So if you see anything, it is pure freaking luck. It is literally random luck. Like, I could just have one and just randomly flash pictures in front of you. So, you know, I went into this viewing world. So what I'd want is some learning system, right? So that's kind of what I want. But I don't know how to write those that will be good enough to get him to rely on. But he does. He actually knows. So I want to separate programming from the model maker, right? So imagine the person there says, so if I was there, I'd say, okay, here's the things I'm interested in. I'm interested in terrorist activity. Here's a bunch of pictures. I'm going to feed a bunch of stuff in. Crowds of people, that's kind of what I'm interested in, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so now assume it goes the way it will always go. The AI is crap, right? Just assume it is. It's fine. So it comes up and it says, hey, Dan, look at monitor 3. Here's crowds of people. And I look at it, and it's a supermarket. Great, because that's what's going to happen. And I'm going to just be like, oh, I hate it so much. No, that's a supermarket. I'm not interested in supermarkets. Those aren't the crowd of people I said. Now imagine 5 minutes later, comes back, and it says, hey, Dan, so, okay, I know you don't want to see supermarkets, and I really respect that. But there's a bunch of cop cars in front of this one. Here on monitor 3, are you interested in seeing that, right? And it shows to me, I go, well, actually, I am interested in seeing that. So here's the difference, right? I didn't try to be the expert system. I'm actually having a dialogue with this computer, and eventually it's getting to a point where we want to go. So for me, that's the future of machine learning, is stop trying to make us computers or computers us, but actually look at this new combination. You know, you think about a million different things, right? I think it's crazy. You know, let's say we're writing a book. I did that once. I'll never do it again. Well, imagine there are two tasks. Today, we tell the computer, well, go proofread the whole book for me. Oh, and here are 7 pictures. Can you please put them into order? But why? Why not just have a combination where it goes, look, you're really good at that. Plus, you have opposable thumbs. So rather than write your next thing for some amazing paper, why not? But now the question is, and this is the tough question, you want to know where it goes. The question is, how do we write this perfect balance where it's not annoying? So those of you who lived through Windows Vista, I apologize. But that was actually Microsoft's attempt to give you control over security software. But we didn't hit the balance right, so it said things like, do you want to do this? It's going to, you know, it's potentially risky. And you went, yeah. And it went, are you sure? Yeah. Really? Yeah. No, I'm not kidding. Yeah. Would you like me to go away forever? Yes, please. So, and then you hit that button. So I don't know how we hit that balance. I think that's the future of it, but that's, to me, that's where it is. Yeah.
Two questions. Todd Snyder. I'm flexible, though.
Are you bendy? That's what we want to
say. How much? Two questions. You said DARPA sold something or other to Google. And first question is, do you get a good price? And then second question is, what role do you see in ontological engineering in any of these endeavors you identified for us?
Okay, so two things. So one, we don't sell anything to Google. Google just picks up. So you misheard. So everything we do is free, and people can have it. What I said is Google acquires the companies that we funded, so we get zero price. Is what I said. Okay. Senator, I didn't know I was being testified, but if that's an interesting thing. So, I mean, I know this is an ontological group. To me, it's fundamental and it's important to for us to, if we're going to build these systems that we're talking about, we're going to have to understand it. But, you know, I guess to me, it's just a component piece. It's a component piece that underlies all this stuff. I don't see it as an end in and of itself. And I think we have to be really careful because I heard a snarky comment a few days ago on the way over, which amuses me, and I think it's one that if I was in this group, we would have to guard against, which is when people don't know what they're doing anymore, then they talk about ontology. And I don't say that to take a shot. I don't actually believe it's true, but I think it's important to know, to me, that, you know, I have a fundamental rule when I ran a company, and I ran a couple, I took one company public, is if your customer criticizes your product and they're right, then fix your product. If your customer criticizes your product and they're wrong, change your messaging. And I would say, for me, we're in that second camp. I don't think anybody works within the field of ontology or has to touch it doesn't understand the importance of it, but perhaps we could do a better job of explaining it, why it's important, how it interfaces with it to get people interested in it, to take that away. So that's just – but it could not have been – it was just the weirdest timing because I was talking to a friend actually at Google. And I said, hey, I'm going over to give this – you know, could I come back to California? I said, no, I'm doing this thing. I'm going to talk – should be fun, and she went, that was her direct comment. So, yeah, just, it's a, better you should hear from me down there.
Stefan Ferra from Image Matters. A question and also a criticism about DARPA. Back in 2000, I know DARPA has invested a significant amount of money in developing ontology, and
yep.
Dimer per soil was one of the standards that came out and became ours since then.
You bet.
No, you were mentioning before that computer, the way we're interacting with computer is broken, and I agree with that. But I think the issue is really the way we build system today is really based on syntax and protocol based, and that makes it very brittle.
Yeah.
And there was this project at DARPA called XData, where you try to integrate a bunch of big data system, heterogeneous big data system, but most of the energy that we put was really on building open source software and try to make that working together, building kind of a system of system, and you dump basically all this data as open source, but it's basically a stack of software, but you still have to figure out how these systems have to work together.
That's right.
And I mean, the semantic can bring a lot of things to solve this problem, and right now Europe is really taking the lead on developing, pushing the semantic web technology. I mean, most of the government and investment in research and development are on semantic web technology, and I'm wondering why DARPA is not following and investing money in research for building reasoner-enabled interoperability of information.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah, no problem. So this is sort of a classic question. It'll answer for lots of people. It usually is, I'm really interested in X. How come DARPA doesn't fund X, right? whatever subject that is. And so here's how DARPA works. So maybe it'll help if you understand how DARPA works. So DARPA, I actually have very little power in DARPA. You would think I have more because I'm the office director, and I think it's in my best interest to pretend I have power, but I don't. Okay? Here's the truth. The way it works is it's all about the DARPA program manager. Somebody comes, they get through our wicket, and, you know, they get to become a DARPA program manager for 4 years, and they get to craft the program that they're passionate about, that they think is the right thing to do and the right way to go. So I just give you, because it's a perfect analogy, I was giving a talk at an NSA conference a while ago on I own all cybersecurity, too. So we're doing a bunch of stuff, and one gal in the front said, I noticed that you have a strong amount of programs and formal methods. I think there's a better approach, right? I think there's a better or there's a different approach. So should I not apply to DARPA or should I not go? And I said, here's the truth. I 3 years ago, I didn't have a strong thing in formal methods. I just happen to have people like Kathleen Fisher and Tim Fraser who are world class in that, and they're interested. If you have something interesting and valuable to bring and you've got a program that will genuinely change the world, you should come and do it. So the answer is the reason X data looks like X data is not because my job – the PM's job isn't to solve all problems for all people. That's what he's interested in, and that's what he's fascinated by, and that's what he goes ahead and does. If somebody else thinks they've got a better idea or a different way to do it, that's the cool thing about DARPA. You come through the hoops, you sell a program to me and to the director, and then you go off and create that community. So that's how it works. So not that your points are wrong or invalid. I think there is fascinating stuff. I'm actually heading out to Europe in late summer and touring these places because I find it interesting. But my entire job really is to constantly try to open the aperture of DARPA and the program managers. But at the end of the day, they have to run what they're giving up, most of them, very lucrative jobs and a lot of, and 4 years of their life. So I've never seen anything great come out of anything less than passion. And it's got to be their passion, not mine or anybody else's. So that's what we do. Yeah.
Amanda Weisdom. I have a comment and a question. The comment is I'm delighted to hear about the open source stuff,
cool.
You know, the putting out there of all the past reports and everything as having worked a number of DARPA projects at various past lives.
Mm-hmm.
I know, and currently one of the repeating head smacks that I have is watching people who are correctly identifying issues around UI and anything semantic.
Yes.
They keep proposing as if it's new, pick your flavor investigation of something that was done in RKF.
Yep.
And there are lots of lessons learned around it. And so I always wanted to say, wait, before you do that, go read all of the reports from RKF because so many things went wonderfully and enlighteningly wrong and then some wonderfully enlighteningly right in that process. Start, you know, before you go, start from those lessons learned. Hooray, and I hope that it gets lots of attention and use. Okay, now my question.
Yeah.
This is going back to the earlier question, but digging more specifically. I agree with you that ontologies and semantic technologies are a component in or are components in
yep.
the bigger picture, not ends in themselves. But I'd love to hear more about what kinds of roles you think they might play in any of these visions that you have from the different programs.
All right, so I'm going to flip it around in classic DARPA way, but I address it to some degree, right? So let me tell you how to pitch the perfect DARPA program, and that's actually how we get at that, right? So I never view any particular technology as interesting or important, although I'm a geek, so actually it's a lie because I just read everything incessantly. But I think the way it works, you only need 5 slides to sell a DARPA program. Right. Now, when you get there, I'm going to give you a bunch of other crap that you have to do, so don't get too happy. But honestly, it comes down to 5, okay? And this is the assignment for you and anybody else that wants to get us interested in the thing. Slide 1, they're really simple. Slide 1, what is the problem? Give me a problem that I deeply care about. If you have to explain the problem to me, you have the wrong problem, right? So any problem that starts with a fundamental flaw in ontology is that is not going to be like, I'm going to cure cancer. That's a good problem. You know, I'm going to let you talk to a computer. So give me some problem statement that I deeply, fundamentally care about. In my case, it has to have some bearing on national security, but I can usually help you out with that because I think I think making the world a better place helps national security, so it's not too hard a stretch. Okay. Slide 2. Tell me the way it is done today, the state of the art. And you have to say, because if you – basically, slide 2 has to say, if you are the first person to think of this as a problem, go back to problem 1. You don't have the right problem. If it's a big problem, everybody knows it's a problem. And tell us, say, look, this is how everybody solves the problem. Here's every solution we've seen over time. This is how it's trending. And usually it's some, like, XY graph that sort of says this is incremental improvement. We want to get up here. Like, if we don't have a vector change, nothing's going to happen, right? Slide 3, my favorite slide, the thank God for me slide, right? Slide 3 says, thank God for me. I realize you are all looking at the problem wrong. And yes, it's an unsolvable problem the way you have characterized it, but if you were to simply relook at it in this way, it becomes potentially solvable, right? So now I'm in pretty good shape. I've got a problem I care about. I know why people aren't going to solve it, so I know why DARPA cares. You've given me some really cool insight, hopefully something that's happened in the last few years. Slide 4, though, is really critical. Slide 4 is an existence proof. Now, it doesn't have to be everything, but either show me on some small amount of data that it can work. Maybe it was even hand-jammed, right? That's what we did on Big Mechanism, but I just showed that you could do it by hand. You could do it. So maybe there's a prayer. Or you can show me that it works in some completely unrelated area, but you go, but look, they applied it over there, and that seemed to work. And then 5 is really simple. At that point, you're pretty much home free. 5 really is just laying out a schedule and a budget and some point in time, 6, 12, 18 months, where is the point when you and I can have a meaningful conversation about whether we are actually making project or not, progress or not? Because remember, we're a project-based agency. You only have 4 years. So continually humping at something that doesn't work is a huge mistake and waste of your time. It's okay to stop a year in and go, you know what, that just did not work. That doesn't make you bad. It doesn't make the program bad. We may revisit in 5 years. It just may not be ready yet. Let's go spend your time. And if you can put them together, and I'll walk you through just a couple, just sort of a fun example. So imagine that I want to do teleportation because, you know, I'm a Star Trek fan, right? So that seems cool. So I can get through the first 3 slides really well. So slide 1, I need to move troops from any point on the planet to any other point of the planet, and I have to do it really rapidly, and that's a huge problem for military force. Okay, I win. There's, like, no other side unless you're, like, on whatever, like some TV news channel where there's always another side. But in the real world, there's not another side. Okay, slide 2. I'm pretty good on slide 2. Slide 2 says, well, here's how everybody does it. Everybody does it by planes, trains, boats. You have a fundamental problem of mass and energy. And so I can't transport lots of stuff. Here are the fundamental rules of physics. We can go back to this. I can only move so much stuff through a medium at such a speed. This is what we can do. Yeah, you can get the hypersonics, but then I can't carry very much. And so I could pretty well. 3, thank God for me. Still, I'm still okay. I'm going to teleport. It's awesome. I'm going to beam up, and I'll beam over there. Problem solved. And then slide 4. When my existence proof is, you know, Kirk, you will fail the DARPA test. So that's why you need sort of all 4 of those. And I've seen programs get derailed. So the answer to you, I think, is cool. But the way to get us to care about it and to think deeply about semantics is, right, to drive back to your question, is think about, here's this thing that we all want, that if we could have it. So don't even think about yourself as doing a semantics or an ontology problem. Think about saying, this is the thing we all want. This is the way it's solved. I cannot possibly solve that. Oh, thank God for me, I've realized this. It may magically be that if I could solve this semantics problem and then show me an example, I'm going, oh, and look, you know, we've done it here, and we've done it here, we've done it here. So it's the same thing, like when we're talking about formal methods. Like, I would not have been able to do the formal methods program at DARPA if I didn't have the SEL Linux kernel. So I think, okay, it's doable. I mean, I don't want to think about how many man years of effort went into that poor thing. But at least I was like, there is a possible goal out there. Now we get to dream the impossible things. And, you know, we probably won't make it, but we'll make progress, and we'll get close. All right? Get you back to your meeting. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that very inspirational talk. Well, that's very exciting. I kind of like that update on the Heilmeyer Catechism. I don't remember the existence proof as being part of that classic DARPA list of, you know, how to put a program together. So our next thing on the agenda is the communique. Presentation of the communique and then an affirmation by the community. So Michael and Leo, you guys are all set, right?
Okay, wow. Never, first law of comedy, never follow a killer act.
But I noticed that you have the break as a motivator to finish this.
Sorry, nobody leaves. Close the doors.
Thank God for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Working.
Okay, so I alluded to yesterday in my opening comments. So for people who are new to the entire Ontology Summit and Ontology Summit Symposium process, as Peter actually mentioned yesterday in his retirement remarks, right from the very first Ontology Summit, there has been a tradition of creating a document that is the synthesis and reflects all of the different viewpoints from the Ontology Summit. And you know, although the first summit was a nice two-pager that was crafted almost that day, and where it's evolved now into a four-month process where there is more than so much input and so much material that gets produced, it's become a lot more challenging. For people who remember the earlier days of the communique, it was, I guess, analogous to the Constitution Conference, where we did live wordsmithing for a document, and it was excruciatingly painful, almost killed the summits, I think. So over time, we evolved the process, and so to have more kind of more synthesis in the communique and more kind of advanced presentation of the material, and so that then at the actual symposium, we kind of endorse it, and kind of everyone gives the affirmation of the content of the communique. So, and in previous years, has also been kind of different. There's usually the lead editors who are tasked with actually writing the communique, and in different years, I can see different editors around, former editors around the table. Different styles were adopted. Leo and I adopted more of a style of actually being the editors, that we see the communique as being a community document, that everybody who participated in the summit has contributed to the material of the communique. And so we, Leo and I, took our roles as being editors to take all of this material and trying to forge it into something that was coherent. And so we tried to come up with a storyline of what we thought this summit was all about, but then took our lead from all the different track champions. And so yesterday we heard from all the different tracks, particularly tracks A, B, C, and D, which are kind of the content tracks. They were the ones that hosted all the different presentations. They were the ones that facilitated all of the different online discussions. And, we saw in yesterday's presentations the sheer variety and volume of all the knowledge that they produced. I guess not too much velocity. There's all the 4 months, not too bad for velocity. And so everyone has kind of seen the communique evolving over the past few weeks. And to some extent, my opening remarks yesterday captured some of the big picture things that we saw coming out of the communique. that for the three focus areas, that I mentioned yesterday, how are ontologies actually being used? How does this differ from existing applications? So, what are some of the novel challenges? I talked yesterday about the idea of, we're building bridges between the different communities. And I think maybe another perspective, say maybe more of a egocentric perspective, egocentric as a community, not just me, that if we're working in the field of applied ontology, whatever definition we give to that kind of field, one of the things that I was always concerned with this summit was what are our blind spots? Right, that we are working on researching various problems, researching various techniques, building maybe various ontologies, but we're all kind of approaching it from our backgrounds, from our areas of expertise. We identify what we're interested in working on, and we go and tackle that. But there's always going to be blind spots that are there, that because we're working on these ontologies, we're going to be missing certain things. And so I saw this year's summit as being a great opportunity to look at what the people who are working on the semantic web and big data, what do they perceive as being some of these fundamental challenges related to ontologies, and then recognizing those and using them as these ideas as challenges to us as an applied ontology community. And so that's kind of where these focus areas arose from. So one was, you know, like really, what are the ontologies that are being used and which ones are not being used? Are we creating content that no one cares about? And if so, what is the content as an applied ontology community that we really do need to be providing? So that was the focus area number one. Focus area number two was saying, okay, well, if we are providing this content, why isn't anybody using it? Why aren't people sharing the ontologies more? Why aren't people reusing ontologies more? And that's what I saw the great presentation yesterday from Track A, really, really attacking that issue of reuse. And so that was a second fundamental theme. And then the third one was, okay, well, if we have we've identified what's the content that we're supposed to be providing, we are kind of addressing the fundamental challenges of reuse, what are the other bottlenecks that are there? And if we look at maybe some of the cultural issues as affecting issues number one and two, cultural in the sense of where, you know, what are the ontologies we're building as a community and how are we facilitating reuse, are the other challenges more on the tool side? And so then what are the tools, the software tools and software environments and other kinds of techniques that can identify what these bottlenecks are and help alleviate these bottlenecks? So these, you know, again, Leo and I were kind of brainstorming and coming up, and out of all the material that was being produced throughout the summit over the past 4 months, these were some of the three key themes that we saw kind of arising out of that. And so really those the three major sections of the communique are each drilling down into each of these kinds of themes. And, you know, the tracks arise, you know, the tracks were identified in early December, like from the early days of this year's summit. But the tracks are kind of the venues for discussing these ideas. And so these are the three ideas. They don't kind of correspond one-to-one with these tracks, but you know, again, every track in some way contributed to each of these questions. So the first main kind of section here is, again, using ontologies with big data and the semantic web. And so the two kind of key ideas here are, you know, one is, you know, again, how are ontologies being used, but also how could they be used? And this is kind of speaking to, again, to this idea of potential blind spots within the applied ontology community. So, you know, looking at semantic web and big data as new eyes on how ontologies can be used, as opposed to maybe sticking to what we know has been working, right? The cliche of, you know, looking for your lost keys under the streetlight instead of maybe where you actually lost them down the back alley. And let's see. So we're in the document, we're the communique, we were kind of focusing again both on the way things work, but also perhaps on you know, the way things aren't working so well. And Christoph Lange yesterday in his presentation of Track B was kind of recognizing one of the key challenges in a lot of semantic web, big data, linked open data sorts of applications, right, is the role that the ontology is playing and the match up between what, you know, the cliche often is the heavyweight ontologies versus the lightweight ontologies. And really the lesson here being, you know, kind of coming out of last year's, I guess, summit in a way, the ontology lifecycle, is really looking at what are your requirements, right? What are the requirements for a particular application? And looking at, you know, what's the right ontology you need to meet those requirements? And so that was kind of another fundamental theme here. And so out of this arose, you know, discussions about the expressiveness of the underlying ontology languages that are being used, the expressiveness of those ontologies themselves, and in particular the idea of really providing multiple, I don't want to say versions of ontologies, but multiple kind of encodings of ontologies in different ontology languages so that they can then be used in the most effective way. So there was some discussion that, you know, maybe one of the barriers to ontology adoption is that it's maybe in the wrong sort of representation language that's not the best best used by a particular application, not amenable to the right kinds of techniques. And so there's a lot of discussion here about the role of expressiveness and the interaction between the expressiveness of the underlying requirement and the expressiveness of that ontology. And the potential idea that maybe building these kind of more lightweight and ontologies and vocabularies, maybe requires some new techniques potentially because of the role that they're playing in their applications. And Christoph mentioned this other too. If you look at web services, the way the trajectory of web services, that there was a lot of effort culminating in 2005, I guess, with the adoption of OLS and W3C, the project, the Semantic Web Services Framework, which were really pushing towards heavyweight ontologies. And I guess cynically, you could say that was really pushed by people in AI who were looking for new applications of planning. But since then, there's maybe been a kind of a revisiting of, well, what are the really underlying requirements here, and looking at some more lightweight sort of approaches. The other issue that popped up in regards to how ontologies are being used and which ontologies are being used is, of course, the issue of scalability. And this still remains kind of a fundamental challenge. One of the things we also have within the communique, at the end of every section, we have a set of either questions or challenges or other sorts of ideas that kind of came up. I'll mention that kind of at the end. I'll come back to these questions at the end. The second main focus area, again, of the summit and of the communique is focusing in on this idea of the shareable, reusable semantic content. And primarily the issue of, what limits ontology reuse. And so within this section of the communique, what we did was to try to say, here's this question, what limits ontology reuse? And then saying, well, maybe it's, there are mismatches and understandings. And saying, that's one possible problem. What is this problem of kind of mismatching? So maybe one reason is for little reuse is that, maybe the ontologies don't even exist. Or if they do, they haven't been designed with the right kinds of requirements. And so we have a little bit of discussion there, kind of, again, coming out of all the online discussions of saying, there are certain aspects of that definitely are true.
I just previously you had the idea of expressivity needed. I think that's one of the mismatches, not using the appropriate level of expressivity there, too.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's mentioned there or referenced back. But it could be.
It could be, yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah, so we kind of just go over, some various possible reasons why there are mismatches and often too, maybe some, misunderstandings that the ontologies maybe do exist, but they're not really designed for reuse, and they maybe are implemented in ways that make reuse difficult. And I kind of alluded to that, said that there was this feeling that the ontologies might be there, but because they're actually written in the wrong language for a particular application, they're never kind of seen.
Or are not easy to find or well-documented.
That's coming later, yeah. So, yeah, not easy to find. So there's finding Mr. Right ontology. We tried getting a little more whimsical in this section. The other sections, it's a hard time being whimsical in the other sections, but we waxed poetic in this section. So as Gary was saying, that maybe these ontologies are there, but they're just so hard to find that maybe if you're optimistic, there's a lot of ontologies, there's so many, it's hard to find. Maybe they're just, again, not really being made publicly available to a lot of extent. Again, even here at the last little paragraph here, is that even when you have found it, maybe it's not really... After going out on a date, it's not really Mr. Right. Maybe there are some other issues there, quality, trust, etc. A third issue was this idea of, the ontology's there, but it isn't quite fit. It's not right there, not the right style, not the right size. The ontology's there, but I can't use it as it is. I have to do something to it. I have to somehow modify it. And there could be many different reasons why. I think this one of the really fruitful threads out of the summit discussions was looking at, like, well, what are some of these challenges here that things don't actually fit? Sometimes an ontology is incomplete in the sense of, it doesn't quite capture all my requirements. So I had a set of requirements that I wanted, and I found this ontology that satisfies 3 out of 4. This one satisfies that fourth one that I was missing over here, but it misses the other 3, you know. And so how do you deal with these ontologies that aren't quite this right fit with our requirements? Here's the ontology might not be in the right representation language that a user needs. And so you have the issue of expressiveness. So, Gary, yep, it's right there. Perhaps it's the ontology actually is too big, right? That modularity is a key challenge here. That, I found this really cool ontology, but it's so huge and it's about biology. But, inside that ontology, I found something really neat about connectivity, because it was dealing with some kind of model of anatomy. So how can I take just that out of that stuff that I want out of this big ontology, and how can I extract it in a way that then I can reuse it, but also which, you know, it extracts it easily. On the flip side, sometimes what happens is reuse often requires integration of multiple ontologies. So, yeah, I can reuse this ontology, but does it play well with others? Can I reuse that ontology and then combine it with reusing that ontology? And so integration arose as a fundamental challenge. And along with integration, all these other ideas like ontology mappings, et cetera. And then finally, there was the thing, maybe people don't reuse ontologies because it's just easier to do it yourself. Rather than go through all the pain of modularizing, of integrating, of adapting, extending, et cetera, just do it yourself. It might take a little bit longer, but you'll have more faith in it. So, this really came out of the track C discussions where they were looking at, and Matthew West presented some of these ideas yesterday, that there are maybe these barriers that make it easier to try to do it yourself, but then you're not really doing reuse. And so, there's barriers of the cost and development, deployment of ontologies, inadequate understanding of uses of ontologies, something Mike Hushel was talking about yesterday in some discussions, right? People don't really understand what an ontology is about, and so they say, this isn't what I really want. And then finally, there were social factors. This came out of track C, so ontologies being designed strictly in one language and then not being accessible to the rest of the world. So people felt this section was a bit of a downer, all these barriers. I find them challenges. I find challenges optimistic things, but people felt it was a kind of a downer. So we also had a section where ontology reuse does happen. And so we were talking here about ontology patterns, despite the dour nature of the previous section. I guess it was this long winter. It's very gray. But then, and even better, so the news just kept getting better in section 3 here. We started identifying best practices. And so, again, track 8 is an excellent session, and every other track sort of jumped onto the bandwagon here. So some of the best practices that we can identify. And so this is kind of learning from both our successes and failures. And so this was a series of best practices that if we as a community adopt, there's the hope and the potential for really encouraging reuse. So in section 4 was addressing that third fundamental insight out of the summit, which was the role that automation and tools can play and the great opportunities that they can support. So aspects here, automated ontology acquisition, how can we best extract ontologies from the data that's out there. So particularly a lot of linked open data and big data problems, the idea is the semantics is out there, but it's just we have to try to make that more explicit. And we also, in the first section, we mentioned the idea of scalability, right? So then, scalability is a challenge. What are the tools that can help us with the scalability problem? So and also in the early section we mentioned modularity. So there's a nice kind of tie-in between some of the challenges that were recognized in the earlier sections, the earlier problems, and then how automation and tools can help support working on those. So looking at tools for modular ontology architectures, tools for actually doing reasoning, so something that came up in a lot of discussions yesterday, for example, tools for doing the mapping and alignment, right? So this was, you know, the challenge of integration and modification, doing ontology tools that support both ontology analysis techniques, but also the idea of hybrid tools. The ability to not just do reasoning with an ontology, but looking at these kind of novel applications of ontologies, like as we're seeing within projects like Watson. Right, and then we have a couple of questions there. But one of the things, so another kind of traditional aspect of the communique is a set of recommendations at the end. So this symposium is the culmination of the past 4 months of the summit, but to a great extent we view this symposium as just being the preliminary step on what is something that's hopefully a longer-term vision. And we've seen this in earlier summits. Peter was mentioning this yesterday as well. The summit on ontology repositories evolved into the Open Ontology Repository Initiative. Ontology-based standards evolved into a special interest group within the International Association of Ontology and its Applications. A lot of these things have evolved on. And so we kind of see some of these recommendations as something that we as a field then can take and hopefully move forward with these. And Leo's mentioned this semantic web applied ontology SIG that hopefully can carry on some of these recommendations. And then what I kind of like at the end here, this is one of the things I kind of like to do, is kind of an issue some of these challenge problems. So really to kind of, we just, in a way within this summit, we just pose these questions. And I see a lot of the future work that we can be carrying on here as trying to address some of these fundamental questions. Some of them were the ones we asked at the very top, right? So what really are the ontologies that are required for some of these applications? Scalability, you know, are the design application of ontologies on the web fundamentally different from existing techniques? But there were some other ones that we kind of looked at, you know, like the role of crowdsourcing in ontology design, and particularly what benchmark data sets. So this is something also that I think Ken Bukowski sort of led with in Track D, was trying to identify use cases and trying to get these benchmark data sets that can help guide the future work with the interregional ontologies.
Mike, you had questions at the end of some sections.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I saw anything at the end of Section 3.
So Section 3, instead of questions, we had the best practices.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we had, you know, again, we had, you know, been posing all these challenges in the earlier sections. So we wanted to end Section 3 on a more upbeat note.
Yesterday we talked about meta-ontology, and I think that what we need is having a way to describe the context of application of micro-theories. And I think that will be one of the topics for future research. I don't see that mentioned in the communique. I mean, maybe you can add that as a topic of future research.
Mm. Yeah, so Peter's mentioned that on the symposium page or on the communique?
On the communique page. For those people who have not been following the last 4 months' work, essentially the communique was input to the communique was closed about like a week ago. So
okay.
2 weeks ago, yeah, Todd would probably tell us more. But I mean, every year when the communique is presented, I mean, there are newer ideas. So started like 3 years ago, we have created another page for people to provide input after the communique has been published.
Yeah, I was not familiar with the process, so
yeah.
Sorry about it.
But definitely, but like Peter was saying, there's the opportunity and there is a venue for providing comments, additional comments, and so we want to capture those. So please add the comments.
Yeah, if you go to the communique page on the wiki, at the very bottom after the endorsement, there's there's a link to further input into the communique, and also there's a further input to the summit, like suggesting ideas for next year's topic.
So is it at the bottom? Where is it here?
The links are there.
Click on the communique first.
Oh, like on the communique draft or the communique page?
Page, communique. Yeah.
For the 6T,
go all the way to the bottom.
Yeah, so this is the wiki version of the communique. And, go down here. Yeah, but here, this is the place to add. So, and this will definitely, be the place to have that.
Yeah, Pat, what you should do if you see a typo or something is send it to us. Yeah, no substantive. No substantive changes. I think we adopted the Fabian rule, right, a number of years ago, so.
But Michael, mm-hmm. Quick question. Can you put the summary on the top?
Yeah.
Just the summary.
Mm-hmm.
No, not the end part of it. No, the last section that you showed.
Oh.
The closures, whatever. Conclusions and recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Keep going down. Now, challenge problems, okay. Now, if you look at the challenge problems, I know you can't make any changes, but if you look very carefully in some of the statements that you made there, are these specific to big data applications or some of those things which we discussed over the years? Many of them, like, for example, crowdsourcing and ontology design and those kinds of things are generic stuff anyway for ontology. There are two things here. One is for ontologies in general and for big data and semantic web in particular, because the theme of the summit is that. So I'm just wondering whether...
I would actually say the only one that doesn't explicitly address how ontologies are being, your challenges for ontologies in the context of semantic and web and big data, the only one that doesn't explicitly say that is the crowdsourcing one. I don't know, people felt that was kind of coming out of some discussions, that people felt that was something that was, maybe something that was kind of arising more in web contexts, the idea of the crowdsourcing of ontology design. But all the other ones seem to, I think, are addressing at least the potentially distinctive nature of the application of that, or of that challenge problem in the context of the semantic web and big data or linked open data.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Just syntactically, every other sentence has the word semantic web and or big data in it. So.
The last one is also benchmark data sets.
Okay, we could put in big data sets.
I just wanted to say, I think that given the structure of this section, the first sentence before you've got sort of the bullets, I mm-hmm. think is, unless one of the bullet points was hard to imagine as applicable, I think the implicit scoping is there.
Mm.
So even for the two points
right.
that don't say it explicitly,
yeah.
I think it's fairly
yeah.
clear.
Any other comments? No. The other thing to recognize as well, and we, again, maybe mentioned this yesterday in some of the opening remarks, is the communique is one of the outcomes, the concrete outcomes and deliverables of the summit. The other is the all the different synthesis pages that came out of all the tracks. The other aspects are the collection of use cases that we want to gather that again, Ken Bukowski initiated. So, and also, again, all the other comments that people have on the communique. So this really is, kind of a living document to some extent that it kind of serves as a way of, capturing what happened as of 2 weeks ago, but also, can serve as a future starting point for other kinds of efforts. And I say, in particular, there's the Semantic Web Applied Ontology SIG, a special interest group that Leo and Mike Bennett are leading among with others, that hopefully will be the kind of the entity that can help facilitate and nurture
a lot of these ideas we talked about, not only in the communique itself, but also in all these other discussions from the summit. So we're really looking forward to all the exciting things that that special interest group is have planned over the coming years. So, Todd, did you want to say anything about the endorsement procedure? Okay. So the other aspect of the summit symposium and the communique is all the participants of the symposium kind of formally endorse the communique, and we have a sign-up sheet that Todd is distributing. And so this, you know, just kind of as kind of a participant of the summit, and like I said, all the material that was here really came from everyone around the table and everyone in the chat and everyone that couldn't actually be here today. All of that input, all this text came from you. So you wrote it. Leo and I just try to make it pretty. So please sign the endorsement form, the endorsement list, to formally affirm the communique.
You're invited.
Invited. No, you don't have to.
Sorry, a couple points. In endorsing the communique, you are endorsing the communique and not the organization
right.
that you may represent. So you have to be clear about that in case you get into trouble with your organization. And there's also a closing time for to put your endorsement on the communique. And Peter, was it a month from now?
We will follow up with Michael, or you will make a post to the list as
okay.
well. And
Michael, but
the community.
Yeah. It.
I guess the your team.
Go team.
Will make a post to the ontology summit list to solicit the rest of the community
yeah.
to endorse, and then you will. Put up the date.
Yeah, we usually close it out after about 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
There's enough time to read it.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a postmortem session
yeah.
scheduled, I think, middle of May. So maybe 15. Closing a day or a couple of days
near
before
there.
Postmortem
yeah.
would probably get us the number. Or if you want more dates, you can do that.
Now, a couple more comments about the communique. I want to thank Leo and Michael for doing a very nice job. They had a really wide range of material to try to incorporate. And if you actually create a table of contents from the communique, you'll see that it lays out very nicely in its logical association and flow. But also I want to thank Leo and Michael because I sent them a boatload of comments, suggestions, and other things that they certain people were complaining about because they were so dense. But they were very nice in accepting them and at least agreeing with most of my suggestions. So thank you. And we missed, though, the last-minute drama of doing live changes. this year, the creation of the communique was the most open that we've had ever, I think. Everyone had sufficient time to provide their views, their comments, their reasoning for changing things. So it was very nice and a lot easier to do. So thank you, guys.
Yeah. So I assume we have formally adopted the communique by the participants here. So I made a post and marked the time on the chat.
I just want to say on behalf of all those who have survived the past communique efforts and with great awareness of how difficult it is to focus in and get a coherent communique on the points of consensus that emerge out of a wide-ranging
mm-hmm.
and sometimes flailing live dialogue. Fantastic job, and thank you.
Yeah, so I guess we have a break now until 11:15, and after 11:15, we will hear from the other really exciting part of the summit. Oh, you want to say?
So what's going to happen next with the
community? Oh, right. So the other thing that again has traditionally happened with the communique is that actually this year I think the form is pretty well in the right kind of format, that it is submitted for publication in the journal Applied Ontology. So as a nice publication there that serves as kind of the archival form of that. So that's one aspect. And I think the other thing, too, is that it really I think that would be the main publication thing. I mean, there might be some other opportunities to use this as a document with which we can approach different venues and conferences within the big data semantic web sphere and kind of use this as a kind of a position statement in a way from the applied ontology community. So that would be another way that it's used. And also, I think it serves as, again, valuable material for the Semantic Web Applied Ontology SIG. But, yeah, primarily the other thing will be this will be published in the journal Applied Ontology. So then, Anu, do you have anything you want to say about the hackathon coming up? Or so at 11:15, we'll reconvene, and we'll be talking about the hackathon project reports. Again, this was the hackathon occurred this year at the end of March, I think March 30th, 31st, and was a truly international effort spanning almost every time zone. And so we'll be hearing summaries of the six different hackathon projects that occurred that day. This is something we started last year, and it was really exciting and proved to be very exciting again this year. Well, we still have four panelists, so if he's not going to be the panelist.
Policymakers coming to Thank you. part of what happens in my experience, okay, so there's a general search engine out there for the world.
Yeah, right. But that's the problem I'm having. This is the problem. I'm just saying that we're wrong.
Like the relationship of the data to the publication,
that's exactly the problem.
Research out there.
And we can make that.
In terms of trying to tell OSTM that software is ubiquitous everywhere. And,
that word win, as opposed to something being useful for
the first one actually, what are the data sets that really are talking to the data set, and then what are the requirements for the application?
Yeah, but it's also in the NDRD.
This is a serious problem.
It'd be like the UMass class diagram, where you actually start with the E.
But you don't even change
that. Maybe when she was distracted, I don't know.
Maybe that would be a killer app. A killer app. They should have said that. But we know what it's like. The UML class diagram is there. It's like to convey to it the other public what it's going to sound that way. Because what you're doing is you're saying, here's this factor that I've accessed. Link where it is that are two classes, but link together. So they can get by without understanding it. And actually, the function of taxonomy and that the distinction between this class and this class and this class and this class and this
I just have a big ongoing battle with people that already have all these values and values and values.
They have all these names.
That's going to confuse people. Maybe if you use the word set.
Perfect. Well, and the point is that perfect because it's very complex. The other one is small. Logically, representing it in terms of finding. I mean, people manually.
I'm talking about design. Doing it first.
Most of
go beyond that,
somebody, okay. I'm here. Do you listen to me? Do you hear me?
So maybe when we introduce this session.
Yes, yes, we can hear you, Anatoly.
There will be a.
Thank you.
Later on today.
Oh, yes.
So.
It's still very noisy here.
Okay. And who is in charge?
Not knowing, it's probably not in my line. No, it's not in my line.
Remind people that they should. That the award hasn't been decided yet, and it'll partly depend on the presentation and
it will be announced at 3:30.
Yeah. It's like a best paper. Some conference is the best paper award, actually, is awarded after the presentation.
Yeah, sure. So is this...
the second annual.
Is this the award, the just the honor of being awarded the best?
Coordinators of the award award winning group get a free membership, 1 year membership in IAOA.
Okay.
And there's a little certificate.
Is it? What is it? Is that normally you have to pay to be a member of IAOA?
Yeah, 50 euros. So it's like a 100 euro prize. Usually there's two people who are coordinating.
Okay, so some value.
It's some value.
Yeah.
And bragging rights too.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the most important thing.
It's okay, you know, all we're doing is
okay.
Making sure they're within the time. That's okay.
Well, we should get started for the hackathon project reports.
Yeah.
Anatoly, are you online there?
Yes.
Okay. Just a couple of announcements. There will be an award for the best hackathon project. The judges are in attendance, and the selection of the award-winning hackathon project will be partly based on the presentations. So heads up for the presenters, do your best, and the award will be presented at 3 o'clock in, I guess, what is the final session of today by Michael Gunninger. So we'll start off with an overview by Anatoly Levenchuk, and then each project will have approximately 12 minutes or so, 12 to 15 minutes to review their presentation. I also wanted to mention that there, at the end of the day, the final session will end around 4, but we will have a birds of feather session from 4 to 5:30. Right now we have one group that is committed to holding a session, and that's on establishing the FIBO content teams. So if anybody else wants to try to spontaneously start a bird of feather session, I suggest they maybe use the chat room to see if there's anybody else interested. The plan would be we'll hold the bird of feather sessions here in this room in just the different corners, and it'll be pretty informal. And we'll have to clear out by about 5:30, but that should be plenty of time. All right, so Anatoly, let me bring up your slides and ask you to begin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good morning. Our virtual real event of hackathon reporting started. And now it's evening in Moscow, and this is a truly worldwide event, like a hackathon per se. This is track E, hackathon results. Co-champions was Dan Brickley and Anatoly Levenchuk, and advisor was Ken Baklavsky. Slide 2, please. What happened? Happened 6 individual hackathon projects in a very diverse topic. And it was about 50 of people that have fun hacking ontologies, hacking codes, and hacking all the ontology engineering, big data, and many other things, artifacts. While focus was, of course, on ontology, and there was not too much link to big data and semantic linked data topics. But still, hackathon fit its purpose, tried to do something with hands, but not simply talking and hearing. like we do now, for example. Most of the projects was planned in to end in one day, but actually take 2 days, some of them 3 days to get results, and even more time it take to form reports. It seems to me that reports today will be slightly more in term of results than it was 1 month ago. It seems to me this is this will not finish today because the work is going on in many of the projects that participated. Most of produced artifacts available and in individual project public repositories. In individual roster page of every in Purple Wiki in every of the projects, you can find URI of these repositories. And reports published, but what changed in this final report? You see today, even in slides, you see multiple diagrams and multiple glimpses of ontology artifacts. This is not only text, but code, ontology engineering artifacts, work in product. And then we will have 6 presentations, and you can list slides from 3 up to 8, and you can see on these slides individual names of the project, addresses of project roster page, how many participants, and a brief result. And please slide 9. If you have any questions, you can still use Ontology Summit list or contact hackathon organizers, for example, me, or directly get in touch with the leader of every participant project. And see you on Ontology Summit hackathon next year. And now I am ready to suggest have individual presentations, and thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anatoly. So, Victor, are you ready to make your presentation for the first hackathon project?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, and I'm bringing up the slides now in the room. And please start whenever you're ready.
Okay.
As you move, when you want us to advance to the next slide, please say what slide we should go to or next slide or something.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, everyone, or good day. Okay, I will try to shortly describe this strange title of the article and describe what we have tried and what we have achieved. The second slide, please. We are working, our company and our broad team are working on ontology-based integration of engineering data. And we are meeting many interesting problems in this work. And one of the problems is to find the common language for education, for discussions, for the domain where working should be transparent both for engineers and to logicians. We have to find people who understand simultaneously such diverse concepts as models, equipment, and ID diagrams, and at the same time logic, sets, properties, inheritance. Few people know both domains, and even fewer of them can use the same terms for objects, which they probably share. And also we have big difficulties in finding good examples to organize discussions. Engineering data is always kept behind corporate firewalls. Ontology research is done in universities on and public examples are sometimes not the very serious ones. So we started to look for a non-industrial example, which will be comparable in complexity to engineering work, and at the same time we will be able to discuss it and to look at it publicly and try our methods, our tools on such a set. Next slide, please. By the idea of Anatoly Levenchuk, who just spoke before you, we arrived to the to work on anime and manga data sets. Production of this cultural project we decided to consider as engineering process. It's very similar, really. Studios and distributions are enabling systems which work on complex systems of the creative products themselves, which are in their complexity and in the complexity of the teams around that them are at least comparable to some engineering products. We can find many interesting analogies between engineering work and work on creative products. And we also understand that we see that the data we are working with is also comparable in complexity, in multiple formats, and also we see the blurred border between structured and unstructured data. In engineering, we see the great interest to unstructured data and natural language processing. And so we think that this domain of can be a good example domain and can be developed, the project in this area can be really developed even farther than we tried to do that. Next slide, please. Here you can see the examples of various data sets. Well, of course, we relied mostly on the internet, on the databases and available on the internet. There are many sites from the known International Movie Database to a great number of fan sites where people collect data about their favorite anime and manga, starting from the personages and teams who are working on that, and all the different naming and all the different languages in which the products are issued. So we had a very good collection of data sets, and some of them or all of them allow to download the dumps or allow access to live APIs, which can work with on the various integration projects. Next slide, please. We have made initial plans. Initial plans were to prepare the set of reference data. Here I have to mention that we decided to work on the general ontology framework of the engineering ontology domain. Engineering ontology domain as it is envisioned in the standard ISO 15926. So we decided to work on the 4D extension ontology commitments. We decided to reuse as much as possible from the federated reference data libraries available for ISO 15926. And we decided to work with the methods which are developed and implemented in the framework of the community of this ISO standard. So we decided to work with templates, which are representation of NRE relations, probably not very common to the general ontology community, but developed in this specific engineering ontology community. We decided to take data sets and transform them to the semantic format, develop patterns, and try to integrate at least pieces of the data from various databases, various data sources. And we had plans to publish linked data as the result of the project and try to make some alternative integrated representation, integrated views on the data derived from the data sources. Next slide, please. The event itself took place on the 29th of March. We worked for 8 hours, and then we debugged and corrected our tools and our instruments for 3 more days. We had 9 participants overall and some guests who were visiting us and discussing our intermediate results. We have worked in only one tool environment, that's 15926 Editor. It's a special tool developed by our company for the ontology integration projects. And so we tested various methods, various instruments developed in this framework. And you can see the reference to our open project repository, where we now published all the initial data sets, reference data, code, adapters, partners, everything which can be used and looked at. Next slide, please. The process that I have tried to describe was to access and study various APIs or XML exports for two final data sets, which allowed us good access to the data, to do modeling, to provide models for alternative identifications, names and the internal database IDs, names in many languages. That was the first study which we performed. And the second, we tried to model work division, the processes which connect title, team, and roles in these teams which are involved in the activity of production of anime or manga title. We decided on URI schema for the data we extracted from diverse databases. We developed reference data through which we described everything, and we developed a set of patterns to describe native database models. On the screenshots, you can see part of our reference data library with classes to hold titles, to hold stuff, to hold activity types, various relations, and the sample of the pattern which describes a title from one of the databases with various alternative identifications and year of production. Next slide, please. Here we are showing some screenshots from our working environment with the results of the project. We have imported 8,000 titles from one database, almost 7,000 titles from another database, and you can see on the right side one of the products with the showing various types of alternative identifications. You can see that this fake anime title had the main identification in English fake and has two identifications in languages, in different languages. Here you see Russian and some probably Arabic alternative identifications for this title. The next slide, please. We have also imported 2,500 various persons involved in the production of the titles. And you can see on the right side of the slide that we have modeled the activity which involves such a person or actually individual and involves in the production of the title in some specific role which he is playing in the production of this specific title. So this were really the results of the first day. We had not enough time to complete linked data representation of the results, so our linked data engine will be part of the new release of our editor. We had not completed integration of two data sources. We tried to do some identification of similar or identical titles, but this will require more code, more comparison of naming in various languages, which is an interesting task, but we had not enough time to complete it. One of the important for us results for us were, of course, debugging of our environment, software environment. We are developing to work with ontologies and specifically with engineering ontologies. And everyone are welcome to test our environment. Everything is downloadable. You can change, augment, and even complete our project. And we will be ready to answer questions and to provide more information to those who are interested in this area, in the domain, and the tools, in what we are doing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Victor. Are there any questions? Okay, great. We'll move on to the next hackathon project. which will be presented by Mike Bennett here locally.
Hi, thanks. Me again. Okay, let's see if I can keep this one brief. This is another long, interesting hackathon. The challenge we had, I think, was I don't do programming, and a hackathon is like lots of hacky people doing really deep technical things, and how could we do a hackathon in the realm of meaning itself, as it were? That was kind of the challenge we set ourselves. So slide two, then. So I'll first start by describing who participated. We had quite a broad global spread. So we had Annette Hopper from France, Brand Neiman from the US, Jeff Braswell from the US, Max Gilmore down in Australia, myself, Mike Bennett, was in the US for most of that time, Mike Dean here in the US, Mirko Morandini in Italy, and Tatiana Polataeva, who joined us from Russia on the second day, and Gary Bergcross, my co-conspirator in setting it up and getting the example data in place and so on. So our challenge then, what could we do as a hackathon that dealt with real meaning, and what would it look like? We decided we wanted to come up with something that would try and integrate and reuse ontologies across different kinds of concept. And so we chose the idea of risk as being something that requires you to integrate stuff from events, situations, statistics, incidents, and so on. And that will give us the chance to think about the semantic abstractions, to unify those, to look at ontology design patterns and so on, and look at all the issues around reuse, aiming towards a kind of notional application, although we didn't ever think we'd have time to do the actual application. We wanted our endpoint to be describing what a nice app might look like. Slide four. That's just not moving on again. Come on. It's not doing it. Ah, a mouse. Oh, there we go. Fantastic. I got the little rolly bar thing. Okay, so on slide four, I'm going to skip over slide four because it's really just a kind of digest of the rest of these slides. So I shall move quickly on to where we started, slide five. So we started with a little brainstorming scoping session. How would we approach this? What area of risk would we look at, and so on? Brand Neiman came up with the insight that we should think of ontologies as a bottom-up thing from looking at example data, but we wanted to also think about how to reuse and conceptualize. So we actually did a bit of both. We did bottom-up from the data. We looked at a few example data sets to think about where we could get to articulate an ontology from, this is where we had a lot of available data on traffic and transport incidents and things. We did take a little detour and look at some drug trials and other things that had adverse effects. And interesting, the word adverse effect there was really very specific to drug trials. We even had a word with them, and they said, oh, well, we could make it more abstract and make it adverse medical effects generally. Still wasn't useful for adverse effects in delays in trains and things. So that was an interesting lesson in this sort of context of applications and so on. So we decided to go with travel adverse events as our focus and think about an application where you had to get from A to B and look at all the risks for that. So on slide six, we then split up the work. So Mirko, I'll describe the ontologies on the next one, and I'll show who did these things as we go through it. So Mirko did the general risk terms, basically abstracting from some stuff he'd previously done on software risks. Annette did the bottom-up, very huge amount of work on deriving an ontology from example data sets. Mike Dean did an ontology for trip concepts. I'll talk more about that, how that extended some existing stuff. Max Gilmore did the ontology for event impacts, and Tatiana then came along and did further refinement on that impacts ontology later on. So we worked collaboratively, firstly through this little diagram, which was really moving and changing the whole time. It's not very readable on here, but we basically wanted a modular set of ontologies We identify what content would be in each of them. You'll see there's a number of other ontologies we import, like trajectories. We had a common events pattern. That event C4DU down there was the event ontology design pattern that we wanted to use and extend both to describe risk events, and it's actually also a basis for some of the trajectory stuff, although that's not shown there. And so we basically started with the idea of a general pattern of risk as being a product of probability and impact being against some kind of goal, in this case traveling and so on, and then worked out how to try and parcel out the work between those. That was on slide 7. So then slide 8 describes the ontologies themselves. I mentioned the risk concepts ontology, which imported the common events, also imported the FIBO goals ontology because the impact of an event relates to some goal. We had the risk assessment looking at the impact of things. The travel adverse events, this was the bottom-up ontologization of the sample data set. And then the trip ontology, which takes a trajectory ontology, which itself extends the event design pattern. We saw in one of the Track A presentations how that was further extended to talk about cruises and so on. So here it was extended to talk about the possible ways of getting from A to B. So our example use case of the person has to get from here in D.C. to Austin, Texas at 9 o'clock on a certain morning. What are the different ways they can get there? And so the trajectory thing went through those different routes, and then the different other ontologies described the risks and the impacts of those risks and so on. So slide 9, then the basic risk concepts ontology, Mirko Morandini took his open source software ontology and essentially generalized it from that very specific application to the more general concepts of the risk event, impact, the goal, as I mentioned, imported from FIBO, and so on. On slide 10, we had a specialized impact ontology that Max Gilmore worked on. Interesting innovation here that we describe both loss and gain as possible impacts, i.e. possible outcomes of something, and so we're able to talk about not just negative risk, but when we look at other aspects, other business areas like finance and so on, one person's loss is another person's gain. So that's some of the thinking that's coming out of the finance community at the moment, which we wanted to reapply here, and the different ways you could mitigate risks and so on. And you'll see that the same common concepts are reappearing in each of these ontologies based around the common event pattern. Slide 11, this is obviously not intended to be read at this level. This is just a tiny part of Annette's bottom-up ontology of the data that was in the travel adverse events. And one of the things we realized later was that as we look at the nature of risks, we need to be able to roll up some of these. So she created this very deep taxonomy. There's several more layers over on the right there that aren't in this diagram that describe all the things that could happen on trains, planes, and automobiles. Slide 12, then, this is the external trajectory ontology. This was the building blocks from which we then extended. This is what Mike Dean created, extended to create the trip ontology. So everything in trip that describes how you got from A to B was built using the building blocks of this semantic trajectory, which shows how some item, in this case me, moves from one place to another within some physical space. So each of these ontologies, the trip ontology itself, I should mention all of these others, we ingested them into a visual ontology modeler tool in order to get a good look at them. In fact, this first one we actually firstly created in the visual tool, but then it got overwritten as due to an issue with the tool, and so this was actually created in Protégé and imported again. So all of these were done in Protégé and imported into this modeler so we could all see what each other's ontologies look like. I don't have diagrams for the trip one, unfortunately, but it contains the different ways you could get from A to B for this example and a number of individuals like stations and so on, which are then to be moved to another application ontology. So we're starting to see how this would look as the final product if you were going to productize this. Slide 14 then. So we basically, to summarize the activities, the different ontologies were created in Protégé, imported into this visual ontology modeler tool in order to get a look at what it looks like. We're neither endorsing nor critiquing the tool here. We're simply showing what sorts of things tools can do in the hopes that that opens up some of the conversations on that. The different ontologies were all created in different syntaxes of OWL, N3, Turtle, and so on. And the idea was to have an overall integrating ontology which would pull all those together. As I say, the travel adverse events one was created bottom up from the data itself. Slide 15. So we reached an end point where there was a couple of things left to do that were tedious but simple. So integrating all of those concepts into a single ontology, perhaps if we were to do it again, we would redispose more of those concepts in different ontologies. In the trip ontology, we realized that there were things we could think about in terms of risk that weren't yet reflected in the travel adverse events ontology, so there's a bit of rolling up to be done there. So that's kind of other work that would be done if we were to continue it. But I think we reached the point where we showed what such an integrated ontology would look like. Slide 16. So then a couple of interesting observations along the way about reuse and so on. Some of the ontologies have a very generalized domain and range for properties, you know, thing to thing and so on, which makes perfect sense when you look at how that individual ontology is developed. But if you're developing for reuse, you might want to say more about the intended meaning of those properties so we would know how and when to reuse them. The tooling we found, visual tooling is very helpful in getting an integrated team to understand what they're looking at. What there wasn't was integrated tooling for having a set of different ontologies with relationships between them and understanding the imports, even being able to move concepts around from one ontology to another, that kind of development tooling. The tooling we had was very good for stable published ontologies on the web with the disciplines that those required, but you need a bit of indiscipline when you're trying to throw it all together. So that was an interesting lesson. Finally, the trajectory ontology, we recognized at the end that it was actually usable beyond just travel, that it would have a lot of applications in logistics and so on. And perhaps with a bit of imagination and more abstraction again, financial cash flows are very analogous to the kind of trajectory issues we're looking at. So actually, we're closer than we thought to being able to do a kind of financial risk application as well. So that's really it. I'm over time, but those are really our conclusions. We exercise both the bottom-up and the top-down extension and abstraction and identify some interesting opportunities from that. So thank you all very much.
Is there a quick question?
Quentin Rowell from Walters Kluwer. You mentioned like the ODPs. Where did you find them? Is that something that was part of the OOP website, or was it something that you determined yourself as being the correct patterns?
So we started with a couple of patterns. One was the event pattern, which had been presented at several of the Track A sessions on reuse, and so we wanted to pick that up and make use of that. Another one was a pattern from the FIBO standard on risk as being a product of probability and impact. And we used that as our kind of unifying factors for how to approach risk in general. And then trajectory itself is effectively an ODP. That was recommended by one of the members of the group who'd worked on it, Mike Dean. He brought that to the table. That extends the event pattern and creates its own patterns. That was it really. We didn't really need to look for more patterns than that.
Mark Underwood, Krypton. Short question about the visualization tool that you used, pros and cons for having a visualization tool or not, and how to interoperate between that and the people who didn't have one.
It was very useful for getting everybody to get a clear picture of each other's ontologies so we could see where all the different patterns were. I would like to have had the same functionality in a more integrated environment where we could move stuff around. And, of course, because it wasn't a free tool, all the work that everybody did was actually in Protégé. So all we used the visualization tool for was to share the insights between the different team members as to what was in each other's ontologies. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Thank you, Mike. The next presentation is on an optimized Sparkle performance management system via a native API presented by Victor Chernoff. Victor, are you there? Victor, are you there?
Are you? Hello? Hello?
Victor, are you?
Yeah.
Hi, Victor.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay.
We've got your slide loaded up, so please give your presentation and let me know when to move to the next slide.
Okay. Our project was named Optimized Sparkle Performance Management via Native API. Slide two, please. The problem, it's hard to select a rather complex data structure by one Sparkle query, but at the same time, it's pretty simple to get all the data using combination of simple queries and then assemble the complex structure on the application level, on the client. This may require hundreds of calls to database, and that leads to using endpoint may be ineffective due to HTTP access overhead. In such cases, it is good to have an API access to the Triple Store that allows running queries directly bypassing HTTP. So the objective of our project was to find out how Triple Stores behave on a simple queries through the native API. Slide three, please. So we have four participants on the event. So three of us were from Russia. Me and Vladislav Golovkov were sitting in the office, and Vladimir Salnikov from Russia, from Moscow, joined us. And Andrei Andreev from Sweden also joined us, and we have had three computers and run the experiments on those three. We selected three triple stores to play with, Virtuoso Universal Server, Stardock, and Nitrox-based RDF storage. So why we selected those triple stores? All three have a very high performance on SP2 bench benchmark. SP2 benchmark is the works on model of library, and it deals with books, magazines, articles, proceedings of conferences and authors, and many years of releases of those books and etc. And how the queries are made for SP2 bench? It looks similar to how ontology applications deal with ontologies. So, and those triple stores have Linux and Windows versions and native API for fast query process. Slide five, please. So we designed, we based on SP2 bench and designed advanced set of queries based on simple SP2 bench queries. SP2 bench has about 20 various queries, and most of them are complex, but some of them are simple. And we extended those simple queries to make the experimentation closer to ontology applications. So, slide six, please. We've set up three computers. That's not something special. It's just general purpose computers, like, as you can see. Slide seven, please. We played with 25 million triple data set created by SP2 bench generation utility. On each round query was sent to server and the full result was read. It's done because some of the triple stores cache the data, and you cannot get the real picture of the performance if you don't do it that way. Each query was run 10 times, query performance measured, and the median value has been taken as a result. slide 8, please. So as a result of experimentation, they got the following conclusions. For ontology applications, it is desirable to have direct access to database, not through HTTP protocol. Sometimes it is worth to simplify the queries as much as possible to make some processing on the client. What is difficult to do with a single large query is easy to implement with a set of small ones. In those cases, triple store should be able to perform small queries quickly. Further performance gain up to 10 times of magnitude could be on the order of magnitude could be reached giving users direct access to database bypassing Sparkle processing, just a direct to API function. The myth that database, RDF databases are slow, I think that's that work not work more anymore, and RDS storages perform fast enough to compete with SQL databases. So actually, what we think, it is time to go through real applications using RDF table stores. So that's slide 9 shows the path to our report, and slide 10, that's all.
Okay, thank you very much, Victor. We have a question, Steve.
Great, seeing you. I was really confused on 2 points that you raised. One was how you were saying that using the API instead of using HTTP confused me a little bit because the API presumably is still going over the internet. And the second was you're talking about this on the current slide, how you're saying RDF database is slower than as well. You're talking about RDF direct access to the RDF store without using Sparkle. And I'm wondering how you access an RDF triple store without using Sparkle. I'm getting a little confused between HTTP, Sparkle, and internet access, I guess. Can you elaborate on that?
So, actually, the first question is about, you say that when we go through API, you don't go through internet. You go directly to functions of the triple stores. HTTP protocol you need to deal with when you get through endpoint. That's unavoidable. But if you refuse an endpoint and you go directly to the server through API, that allows you to avoid HTTP protocol. The second query was, can you repeat the second query? Second question?
The second query was talking about you were saying how you were accessing the RDF triple store without using Sparkle. Is that what I understood you to say?
Okay. So Sparkle, Sparkle is just another layer that gets some overhead. So if you go directly to the functions, don't use Sparkle, but use the API to the server, to the triple store, you can get some performance gain.
About bypassing the RDF layer like it's an underlying relational Oracle server or something? Is that what you're saying?
No. You go to the RDF, but using API functions, not using Sparkle. Directly to triple.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions? Yeah, go ahead. State your name and...
Dave Blevins, Booz Allen Hamilton. I had 2 questions on the methodology. Why did you select the median rather than the mean to analyze the results? And do you think reading the entire result set would introduce data artifacts than if you simply ran the query and saw if the results were valid?
Okay. So median, we thought that median gets more correct result when you get when you have, say, very a big amount of small values and say one big value. So actually, it gets more correct median than just average. So that we saw. And what is second question? Could you please repeat it?
Do you think reading the results, the entire results, would introduce data artifacts into your analysis?
It looks like I don't understand what you're asking.
Could you repeat that? Do you think reading through all of the results could introduce errors in your data, as opposed to querying and having the query run without reading through all, you know, if you have 5 million results, reading all 5 million triples in addition to running the query?
Maybe you're asking about, let's say, on each run, query was sent to server and full result was read. You mean that? It was done because some triples have a caching, and actually without reading full results, you cannot get a real data. You cannot get a real information about the performance of the data. So that's why.
Okay, thanks.
I guess you can ask through the ontology summit list and get a better answer.
Yeah, I think we need to kind of, we have three more talks here. And next talk is on OntoHub consolidation. I guess Till is going to present this from remotely, or Oliver. Who's going to present that, Peter? But whoever is that, you're on mute. Yeah,
I'm
unmute.
Till Mosakowski or Oliver Kutz on the call? No.
6 o'clock in the evening, I guess, there.
I see Till
Mosakowski
on the
chat. Yeah, tell him he's not on the call.
Till? Can you unmute? Can you unmute Peter? Can you unmute him or no?
No, he's not.
He's not there.
He's not there.
Yeah.
Maybe he's having some difficulty getting onto the call.
Oliver,
ask him.
Shall we move to the next presentation and come back?
Right. Maybe we should come back.
Maybe we can send him a message and. Okay, the next one is Amanda. Are you presenting this, or okay? Let's go with it then. Well, if we tell that Olivia doesn't come back, you have an early lunch.
Well, he said on the chat now, he's going to call in.
Just call in. Okay. Okay, he missed his chance.
Okay.
Very competitive word.
Okay. In the meantime, our hackathon was an attempt to stop talking about it and start doing something about it, start implementing something, to build a catalog of characteristics of ontologies and vocabularies that are relevant to the suitability of those ontologies and vocabularies for semantic web and big data applications. I'll say more about the motivation for that in a minute. Slide 2, our participants, the core team is myself, Andrea Westernan, back there, and Simon Spiro. We had a few drop-in observers. and a drop-in contributor, Anatoly and Dan both dropped in as in their capacity as the chairs of the hackathon in general. We were working in an area that Dan's very familiar with and had thoughts about, so he actually made some active suggestions and contributions that were most welcome. Now, what was the point of this? Sorry, this is slide three now, objectives. Something we kind of knew in general, but we heard specifically in the reuse track, in the bottlenecks track, and various scattered places. In figuring out what ontology or metadata vocabulary or other artifact you might want to use, or whether you want to use a specific one, it's important to not only understand your own requirements, but also to be able to find out what are the specific characteristics of those potential candidate vocabularies and ontologies. But there isn't an existing standard way to describe that. There's some metadata available at a very high level on these objects in various repositories, but it's not at this granular level, and it's not particularly standardized. So what we wanted to do is get a move on, get this catalog started, make it open source, collaboratively developed, extensible, publicly available, all the things that could make it a sustainable, growing thing beyond what we could get done in a weekend with three people. And importantly, our envisioned uses were fairly wide-ranging. So we imagined people using this catalog to manually create metadata for vocabularies and ontologies they're publishing to help other people use them. We imagined evaluation tools and methodologies representing the outputs using this vocabulary. And we imagined repositories using this vocabulary to provide metadata on the artifacts in those repositories. And to generally to try to take a bite out of this problem, right, of useful description that can help with reuse and with the bottlenecks around reuse. So what did we actually do? Well, we kicked it off, gave it a name. It's the Vocabulary and Ontology Characteristics Relevant to Evaluation of Fitness, or VOCREF. Not entirely, it's not the catchiest, sexiest thing in the world, but it's tolerable and not terribly loaded in such a way that it's going to instantly alienate any of our intended communities, so we're going with it. We created a GitHub repository. The link isn't actually a link in the slide, unfortunately. I don't remember why I did that or how I did that, but it's up there on GitHub. It's at GitHub/VOCREF, you'll find it, and it is expected to stay there. And any current and future contributors are welcome to fork that repository, work on it freely, and submit extensions, fixes, additions as pull requests to initiate integration into the main vocabulary. We decided to work in AL2. Not because it's anybody's favorite language, but because it is the most widely adopted. It's the thing that any of the repositories or tools that we were thinking of would probably be able to use. and so, whatever the pros and cons of it, we said, okay, we'll start there. We'll go with that. Simon saved us from a lot of pain by pointing out to me when I had first got the repository stood up that the OWL functional syntax works a lot better with version control than any other serialization. So we declared that our official stored mode. And we wrangled some modularity considerations into an initial architecture, which I'll describe in a few slides. So what did we actually do during that time, during the weekend continued? Most of our work on Hackathon Day focused on our top-level module, which is the one that should contain the most basic concepts related to ontologies and their evaluation with respect to these potential application areas. And we this is one of those moments where a lot of people want to point to a number and say we grew this by this many concepts. We shrunk this by this many concepts, right? We, you know, I had initially imported a lot of concepts from the output of last year's ontology evaluation hackathon, and a lot of it came back out. Why? Because it wasn't relevant to this year's particular focus, right, on what matters for semantic web and big data application reuse, or because it wasn't specifically clear enough, or it may be something a lot of people evaluate. It's not obvious that it's relevant to usefulness in any way. Those are some of the examples of things we pulled out, or some of it was redundant with something else. Anyway, we did add stuff as well, but we got a lot of weeding done. And we got a couple of initial content modules, one looking at some characteristics specifically having to do with lexicalization and whether an artifact is suitable for use in NLP. another, and now I'm forgetting what the other content module was that got started. Doesn't matter now. So we got that, some modules going, initially populated. We also gathered a whole bunch of stuff to consider for inclusion, right? So there's a section in the repository for references and resources. There are candidate ontologies for reuse in there, right? You can imagine what some of those are. I may have a list on another slide. And we started going through some of those. We also built up quite an issue store, and this is I want to emphasize the importance of this, particularly for what I consider good methodology in ontology development, but also for a collaborative open source project. We have identified, currently, as of right now, there are 47 issues in that issue store. 30 of them were closed by this time, so that means we addressed them. 17 are still open. They are important because identification of an issue is a requirement specification, right? It's something that needs to happen or needs to go into this or needs to be fixed in this, right? And it's also a handle for discussion amongst the collaborators. You know, do we want to include this particular thing, or I'm confused about what this means, allowing the collaboration point. And it's also a mechanism for coordination collaboration. So people can come in and anyone can add an issue to the store, right? If they say, well, for me, this particular characteristic is important and I don't see it here, I can open an issue on it. And anybody can come in and assign themselves an issue and say, I'm going to try and fix this or build this part in. And because they've assigned it to themselves, other people will know it's being worked on by somebody, or by them specifically. We also put milestones on some of those issues. One of the ones that we wanted to complete during the hackathon remains incomplete, and that one is adding sufficient annotation to the concepts that were reused from last year's hackathon. That's assigned to me. It's still open. Oh, sorry. Okay. We had, as Mike mentioned with his hackathon, we had some issues with having a tooling that's both robust to the things we needed to do and enables simultaneous visibility. Don't have that. we had Google Hangout instead. We simultaneously coordinated our work through that. Specific things about our approach that are worth noting, we were focusing on the specific characteristics that we have reason to believe are relevant to the suitability for applications in semantic web and big data, not just any old thing anybody evaluates, especially if they've come up during this. We were looking to reuse existing treatments, whether they're on an ontology form or a paper or a specification, and leaving out things that didn't meet those criteria. Some lessons, things that are not as useful as one might think, but there's a lot of material about them. We pretty much set aside for the purposes of the hackathon consideration of the overall type of object something was. Is it an ontology or vocabulary? That's not actually particularly useful when you're looking to whether you use it, partially because those are not standardized classifications. It doesn't give you much granular information about what this thing does, right? It's different in a case where that's a standardized thing. So if you say, oh, well, this, if we did add vocabulary to say this meets a standard, right? So if it is an ANSI NISO Z39 point something or other controlled vocabulary, that's informative, right? Otherwise, you get a lot of heat and not a lot of light. Instead, we're looking at, does it support reasoning of this type? Does it have a lexicon in this language? Does it, et cetera, et cetera? That's the level of information you need. And I'll leave the rest of that for you to read since I'm over time. Very quick point on modules. We had as a goal to both have small modules to enable people to grab just pieces that they wanted, and also the ability to link to existing things and grab the whole thing if you want. We ended up basically with a spindle architecture. So we have different content modules, the very, very, the most general, more specific ones people might not need for a particular use, and externally mapping between those and external vocabularies. So, and then lower level gathering or integration modules, so you can get just all the native content with all the mappings, you know, one grab and go module that imports everything. So you don't need to worry about it if you don't want to. And slide 11, what's in the repository right now, references and resources, starting start at the test and evaluation resources, like capability questions and so forth. The modules that I mentioned, whoops, and the issue store, and it will continue. We think we got a good start. It's solid enough that maybe with a little more documentation to introduce it, you know, maybe including throwing this up there, so that newcomers can orient well when they get to it. It's ready for other people to start contributing, and we hope that people will.
Okay, thank you, Amanda. I don't think we have time for questions. So we're going to move to the next talk here. And, a little behind, but that's okay at this stage, I guess, 5 minutes. Pardon? Yeah. Still, yeah. Still there?
Yeah, he's still. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Still, your slides are up. You are on slide one now.
Okay, so that's about hackathon project OntoHub consolidation. Let's go to slide two. OntoHub is a web-based repository engine for ontologies being distributed and also written in multi languages like OWL, Common Logic, RDF, more complicated logics as well, first order, higher order. There's a prototype available at ontohub.org, and we have the goal to follow the open ontology repository architecture and API. We have some mirrors currently of some important repositories like BioPortal, Tones, Colora, and SoCorp, or there's a typo there, sorry. And as OntoHub has also been used as a repository for the voice competition, and it will be used as the central tool for the forthcoming OMG standard ontology integration and interoperability onto IOP. And we recently have added the Git integration as a central new feature. So Git is a decentralized repository, which is now used by many software projects. And there is GitHub, which is really fastly growing, and many people are using it. And you can easily fork projects there and so on. And so OntoHub is basically the name is also, and also the design, a bit inspired by GitHub. And so you have Git versioning there in this ontology repository, and you can also use any Git client for maintaining your ontologies. And this integration of Git caused a lot of problems, and therefore we needed a consolidation phase. So that's why this topic of the hackathon is just consolidation and not some exciting new feature. The results of the hackathons, so that's now on slide 3. There have been 10 participants. 9 have met locally in Bremen in Germany. 1 was from Toronto, remotely connected, and he was new to OntoHub and wanted to write a new deployment script. So that was great that we could also get some new people involved. And we actually have managed to close an important milestone voice competition, which has been open for months and has had many complications. There was one severe bug concerning a complicated database transaction, and we actually managed, because we had all the people together for one day, we managed to find that bug and eliminate it, and yeah, lots of other stuff. And so this was really an important milestone to close this voice competition milestone. And you have some links here at slide 3. And so just to give an idea what OntoHub is, on slide 4, there's a screenshot. So you see that OntoHub is structured in different Git repositories. And we have the BioPortal clone there. We have Colora there. We have concept portal, there are other things. And each of these is in own Git repository and can be maintained kind of separately. Slide 5, here you see the file browser view for a specific repository, in this case BioPortal. You see on the left-hand side, the left column contains the file names, and the right column contains the ontologies, the ontology names. So we differentiate between a file and the associated ontology. There might be also files not providing ontology, and there might be files containing multiple ontologies. Therefore, we have this differentiation. And you can also see on slide 6 that there may be folders, and so you can also organize your files hierarchically in the repository. But that's basically all known from GitHub, so that you can browse your repositories. Slide 7, now that shows you if you go into some ontology, this is now an OWL. There you can have, as usual, the class tree, and then you can also browse object properties and other stuff. So you have different symbols there. But the important thing is that this view now also works for example, for common logic theories or for other first-order theories, so it's not bound to OWL. Slide 8, here we have a history of a repository. Here you see the commits and the Git commits, and then you can view Git diffs between different versions and jump onto different versions. That's also possible. Then slide 9, here you see again the file browser now with a CLIF file, CommonLogic, so it's not OWL, it's CommonLogic, and we have the integrated code mirror, and this also was completed only with the voice milestone. So that's also a result of the hackathon that this now works. You can click on an edit button and then you have a web-based editor, and then you can edit this. Syntax highlighting has yet to come, but then you can write a commit message and press the commit button, and then you automatically generate a commit in the Git repository. So if you can use Git without having any Git client, using the web-based interface. Slide 10 shows some metadata. So we have different kinds of metadata for the ontologies. And here you see a category tree. It's similar to what you have in BioPortal, but BioPortal is very restricted to biological and medical ontologies. So we have developed a more general taxonomy, which is also maintained as an OWL ontology. And here you see the different ontologies in the different fields of the taxonomy. You can also click on the pluses to get a more fine-grained view, and we still have to classify many of the ontologies, so the classification is not complete. Okay, I think that was it. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thank you. We have plenty of time for questions here. Steve, you had a question?
No.
Well, you can voice it your time.
Steve Ray, CMU. I was just noticing you had this edit, and I was sort of wondering what the implications of editing a repository file was. And I guess it's a mirror. I mean, was there controls over who can edit what? Things like that.
Good question.
Yeah, indeed, good question. So, currently, you can only edit if you have the rights. So there's also right management per repository, not per ontology. In the future, we plan that you can also edit if you don't have the rights. And then if you commit, there will be automatically a new Git branch created. And then you can later on, the maintainer of the repository can decide whether he wants to merge the branch or not.
And then we have Michael. A chat question, and then Michael, I said.
No, Christoph. Christoph.
Okay. Stop. Hello, this is Christoph Lange. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Still a question on slide 7. You said, if I got it right, that this class hierarchy view also works for languages other than OWL. If I got this right, how would it work for Common Logic?
No, sorry. The view with the different kinds of symbols. So in Common Logic, instead of classes and object properties, you would have names and sequence markers. Although we also think of extracting class hierarchies from other languages, like Castle, there you have the subsort hierarchy. We also want to include QML class diagrams. We have, for the time being, integrated MOF, the meta object facility, which is similar to class diagrams, and there you would have the class hierarchy, so you would have a similar view there.
Thank you.
Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
Michael Eschild, Semantic Arts. So it says it's a beta, and I see lots of things in it. So my question is, how mature is this? If I decide to start using it, is it just going to work just fine? I mean, like any decent piece of software, although there's always going to be nice things about it. Or is it pretty early days and I'm going to have to struggle along because there's lots of things that aren't really working yet?
So you see at the screenshots, it's beta quality, OntoHub beta. So I would guess it's not ready for productive use yet, but we want to have it ready soon, say by the end of this year. You could use it productively, roughly estimate. The nice thing is that you have a Git repository below. So for Git, you have very mature tools, and you always have, even if everything else fails, you always will have the Git level. You can always maintain your repositories, even if the OntoHub server should be down for some reason. But of course, we want to reach maturity also for for everything in OntoHub, and yeah, roughly estimated end of the year.
Thanks. It looked for the most part pretty good. What would you say the one or two things that really need to have a lot more work before it's ready for prime time?
Yeah, one is kind of stability. So we have still that some ontologies fail. So they basically are analyzed, but are not really, there are errors. Sometimes in BioPortal, some imported ontologies do not exist. So there are all kinds of nasty problems there. And it's not always easy to tell, because we integrate several tools, who is responsible for that, or it's the fault of the ontology. So that's one problem. Another problem is the smoothness of the user interface would be also improved.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we have two questions here. Peter Rim, and then we'll take this.
Till, if I put in an OWL ontology, can I get a common logic ontology out, and vice versa, or when? If not now, when?
Yes.
What?
Yeah, you say.
Is that yes? Did you say yes?
You lost him?
Till?
Sorry, there was a problem in the connection. So you can translate OWL to Common Logic. There is a translation. And you can even, in the distributed ontology language, you can write down some ontology where you take your OWL ontology and write the OWL ontology, and then with logic translation, and then your mapping from OWL to Common Logic, and then you get a Common Logic ontology. So that's possible. Vice versa, it's not possible yet. We also plan to have that to project ontologies, but it's more complicated how to do this.
Thank you.
Okay, last question.
I have two questions.
Yeah, please state your name for the purpose.
Yeah, Stefan Feda from Image Matters. I think this tool is a great tool, and I really feel a niche that's really needed. I've published a bunch of geospatial ontology for OGC, and I'm looking for a place where people can contribute and feedback on this ontology and make change. So I have two questions. First, what's the programming language that this website is built on? And my second question is, how versioning of ontology are managed? I'm not talking about Git. Text-based versioning, but more conceptual and change of property at a conceptual level.
Yeah, good question. So the programming language is Ruby on Rails, but we also interface with other tools like the OWL API written in Java and the heterogeneous tool set for logic translations written in Haskell, but the main framework is Ruby on Rails. Answering the second question, so you can take versions, but that's all. We don't have a conceptual versioning yet. We just have the Git versioning. That's an interesting point. We should have a conceptual discussion about this.
Okay. Thank you, Dale. I think we need to pass on to the next speaker. It's going to be Ken remotely speaking, I guess. Ken, are you there? Is Ken on the chat? Or,
Hello, is it? Can you hear me?
Ken?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on slide number one.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about the semantic annotation of the Ontolog Community Environment Hackathon. If you go to slide number two, the background of this is that as you know, the Ontolog Collaborative Work Environment, of which its wiki is a very important part, has always served this community. And it's been been many years, actually. We've been involved, many people have been involved in attempting to ontologize, you know, basically to annotate and to use wiki content because it's such a rich source of information and knowledge about ontologies for our community. So this is actually this hackathon is really just one of a long series of efforts in this direction, and we expect that it will continue in the future. So we just have a number of goals that we hope eventually will be achieved, and in fact we've made a lot of progress toward them. On slide 3, the specific goals of the hackathon were to try to extract the semantic content from the pages, specific pages on the Ontolog Wiki, the ones involving conference meetings, and to extract calendar type information from them. But we wanted the code to be general enough that we could then extend it to get other kinds of semantic content from these pages. The idea is that this would be kind of, it ended up being the kickoff for the development of an entire semantic ecosystem based on the Purple Semantic Media Wiki. So going to slide 4, the Ontolog community environment is going to be on the Purple Semantic Media Wiki platform. It is the content that is currently on the website is being migrated, and we are going to be semantically annotating it. So we have some categorization already. The hackathon was mostly concerned with extracting properties such as date, starting time, duration, chairs, speakers, participants, and so on. Going to slide 5, now this will show you what a typical page looks like on the current Ontolog Wiki. It's one of the sessions of the Ontology Summit this year. And so you can see there is a great deal of interesting semantic content there. Now if you go to page, slide 6, this shows at least the beginning of what the actual page looks like underlying that view on slide 5. So the wiki actually takes this kind of text that you're looking at on slide 6 and converts it into the HTML page that you see on slide 5. So, but this is of course just the first part of that page. Now, the next slide, slide 7, shows what a typical page, or this is actually a small version of one page in the new Purple Semantic Media Wiki. So this, it's not the actual page, it's just a mock-up of one with a little bit of content so that I can show you what's going on. It was some of the information from Track D, Session 1. Now if you go to slide 8, now on slide 8 you can see what the page source looks like with annotations. Now the first Ontology Summit to them, that's just an ordinary link. The semantic annotations are the properties of the page and the categories of the page. So we have the two champions and the three speakers that were at this session. And then the last items on that slide are the categorization of that page. So we're saying that this page is in the meeting class and it's in the Ontology Summit 2014 class. So basically specifying this page as a resource, it's an instance of these two classes, and it has a number of properties. So I think you can recognize this as semantic annotation. Notice that in addition to annotating it for semantic purposes, these also show up on the page. So if you go back to slide 7, you'll see that those links you see the links there. You don't see that it's being marked as a property, but they do show up as links to those individuals, their personal pages. And this last category here actually determines the look and feel or skin of the wiki page. So because it's in this category, you then see on slide 7 that banner up at the top and the particular look and feel of the rest of the page. If you go to slide 9, now this is another page. And what's interesting here is that it is extracting content, semantic content, from other pages, specifically from that page we just saw, where it lists the champion and the speakers. And of course, if there were other pages in this category, meeting pages in this category, it would also extract those that information and show it. So it's dynamic content that just gets generated whenever you look at that page. So on slide 11, I show what we hope to achieve. What we hope to do is take the content that I showed before, current page, and then annotate it as is shown below. So the date, for example, will now be specified as has date. Categories will be specified for that page. If you look at the next line, it says show, so it's actually going to be querying another page and showing the theme of the overall summit. So you'll only have the theme in one place. The session topic will be specified as a property, and the chairs will also be properties. Panelists will be indicated, and so on. So you can see the kinds of annotations that we hope to have on these pages. So now going to slide 12. Sorry, I kind of got lost there. The semantics of Semantic Media Wiki are not that rich. The resources are the whole wiki pages. We have categories that we can use for classification. There is a subcategory hierarchy, and properties are supported, data type properties, object properties, each with its own wiki page. And software has been developed for mapping from RDF to Semantic Media Wiki. Slide 13, the hackathon software was developed. We did have some difficulty with authentication, but we did manage to get things parsed and updated, and also to use the Google Calendar web service. Going to slide 14, here are the participants that were at the hackathon. It appears that the font kind of was messed up. I'll try to fix that. We had 6 students working, as well as myself, Peter, and Tejas Parikh, each of whom had a duty to develop software for the hackathon. The current status on slide 15 is that we have developed a prototype, a few problems, although we've managed to fix them. And the students are still active, and they intend to continue working on it until during the rest of the summer, actually. They couldn't continue immediately after the hackathon because they had to finish their semester. Slide 16 now. This is what we intend to finish by the end of the summer, is an integrated